This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. To make this show what it is, I have to talk to people in person, face to face, not on Skype or on the phone. That means I have to travel around the country and find recording spaces wherever I go. That's expensive. And so far, this show is entirely supported by the contributions of listeners. So if you want to keep it going, please do me a favor and go to unregisteredunderground.com. When you become a subscriber there, you'll have access to a private Facebook group where you can talk with me and with guests from the show. You'll also get discounts on Unregistered and Renegade University merchandise. So again, to support this show and to keep it going, please go to unregisteredunderground.com. My guest this week is not who he's supposed to be. He's a Jewish guy from New York, but he was raised by a single mother who struggled to make a living. He dropped out of college after one semester, and he hates left-wing politics. He's a stand-up comedian who learned his craft during the age of The Daily Show, but he doesn't rely on meanness or snark to make people laugh. Dave Smith is also a libertarian, but he really seems to care about people. So I started hanging out with libertarians about 6 or 7 years ago, and I still am not a libertarian, and I got a lot of issues with them. But I did have one rule right off the bat, which was that if a libertarian isn't passionate about two things, I'm not really going to hang out with them very much. If they don't care as much about war and prisons as they do about taxes, we're not going to be friends. But I saw this stand-up comedian talking a couple times, actually several times, in fact, and I could just tell. Not libertarians will talk the talk, but I think I got a feeling from this guy that he really did care. And these were the first issues he brought up in his long list of grievances about the state. And so that's why, that and the fact that he's really funny and seemed like a nice guy, I said, I got to talk to this guy. So Dave Smith's here. And thanks, man. I've really been looking forward to talking to you. And I just feel like I think this is going to be nice and fun instead of a fight. I just had a really, really awkward conversation with someone from my old world, the academic left, and it was just as uncomfortable as it could be. And then
I'd imagine.
Yeah, it sucked. And but then I thought afterward, and I was just feeling terrible about it, really depressed and thinking, oh God, I can never go back home. You know, they've completely cast me out. I can't even talk to these people. But then I thought, well, at least I'll be talking to Dave tomorrow. So thanks for coming. I have one question for you to start off with.
Sure.
What the fuck are you doing being a nice Jewish boy from Park Slope as a Ron Paul libertarian? How did that go down?
Oh my God, I don't know. They trapped me somehow.
I heard about that. The Kochs just funded some secret agents, and they kidnapped you, put some drugs in you.
It was like a Manchurian candidate, like a phrase went off. They were like, you are ready for the Ron Paul revolution. You know, I got... I just got really interested in Ron Paul in 2007. I found his campaign really just different than anything I'd ever seen. And it was like, to me, like the first guy ever. And I still to this day look back, I think he's the only presidential candidate of my lifetime who was like, I'm going to tell the truth. Uh-huh. I think every other president, even the good ones you could think of, were like, I'm going to hold back on this. I'm going to hold back on that. And I just started reading everything I could get my hands on about the subject, and I was like converted. It was just utter logic that mm-hmm. converted me, and then I guess I just couldn't go back after that. And I think I share some of your kind of the frustration you're talking about when you're talking to this your leftist friend on the phone, where you're like, But if I've found an argument, it's like I was with you, but I found a better argument. So let me just present it to you. And then you should be like, oh, great. Thank you for showing me this argument. And it's like really heartbreaking that that is not the reaction of people.
Yeah.
It never is.
The metaphor that I'm using increasingly, because it's becoming more and more clear to me, is that it's a church. I think all sort of political groupings are churches in a sense, but there's a really powerful, strong church that's been in power for a long time on campuses and among the left that I was a member of. I was born into that church, as a lot of people know. And I just think that's it. It's either a church or it's family. So when you start to talk to people, this is my experience, like that, and you just present a counter argument and, you know, all the evidence, and it just, they'll even sort of acknowledge that all the evidence is correct and the argument is a good one, but then they'll just say, well, but I just, that's not okay, because poor people will starve. right. And so that's why I think they have to come to this on their own. We're not going to be able to convince them.
No, I agree. I think when you are, if you're arguing with someone on the left wing or someone on the right wing or whoever, many times, especially if you're arguing with someone who's like really dug into their position, mm-hmm. you're kind of arguing for the reasonable person watching. Yeah. You're not really, you know, like you're not really about converting this one person. Because no, truthfully, if you dig your heels in to one team, you can find evidence that backs up what you believe. You can always, you know, you can find a way to make sure you're like, I'm gonna find my narrative out of this. I had the other day, I was on a CNN panel, and this Crystal Ball, who's very nice, but she's, you know, like a Democrat, a left leaning person, and we were talking about this terrible, terrible story of this 8-year-old kid who was like bullied in school, got beat up really, really badly, and like beat unconscious, and then killed himself a couple days later. Like a really, really terrible story. And she goes next, and they go over and they ask her about it, and she goes, "Well, you know, I'm just gonna say it. When we have a president who bullies people, then I think." And you're like, "Come on, wait, like, come on. Are you really just forcing your narrative onto this story? Like, it's an 8-year-old getting in a fight. I don't think politics had anything to do with it." Like what are we doing here? But people are just so dug into like, this is my team.
Yeah.
And you know, I always say the football model, you just look at, I would talk about this during the election, but you're like, you know, you take a step back and like, human beings, this is what we love to do. We love to get into a stadium, go, I'm on red team, you're on blue team. Let's lose our minds mm-hmm. over who got a ball over a line. And by the way, we know there's nothing on that. Like, we know this is just a game mm-hmm. and we're still going to be like, ah, yes, red team. And then, I mean, that's really all they're doing when it comes to politics. I mean, it's the same thing.
With sports, you know this, people organize their whole lives around their team, right? This is really, really important to them. For most Americans, I would say, certainly most men in this country, sports is far more important than politics. They're more tribalistic about sports, right, than even politics.
Yeah.
But that's what you're talking about, tribalism, right? Yeah. So it's a problem. I think, you know, of course the worst tribalism is nationalism. That's what really gets you killed.
I think, statism, nationalism, anything where, any type of like authoritarian collectivism is where you're going to be in the most trouble. And I think that's probably, there's probably been religions over time that fall into that, and governments and. But I mean, that's very dangerous.
When you convince millions of people to willingly go fight and die in a war in a country they've never heard of before, that's really something. But that's nationalism, you know?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Because this is our tribe, which really is like, this is our family. You know, it's that deep. It's that intimate for them, I think. They've merged their identity with the nation state.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
No, that's right.
Does it make sense?
Yes, no, I think absolutely. And there's a... It's almost why the nation state at every point is at war with every other competing would be identity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they always want the state to be your identity.
That's very
important. And that's what's interesting. Like, you see that always where it's like, you know, whether it's like Marxists and the church or something like that, where they're like, you can't really have both. You're like, well, we're both kind of trying to be, you know, your ultimate high power.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think almost all Americans, I think even probably you and I, have some of that in us. Like, there's some America in us, you know? If you looked at a Venn diagram, there'd be at least some overlap there. And we just can't help it because we're acculturated. We lived here. We grew up here. But, you know, and then there are people who are fully merged with the nation state. You know, someone like, I don't know, James Mattis or someone like that, right? but, you know, and then everyone else is sort of in between. But that, to me, that's the real battle. That's the real question, or that determines whether we live or die, literally,
right,
in large numbers, is how many people are on Mattis's side of that, right? So it's a cultural question for me. Everything's a cultural question. And so it's not just making these very logical arguments, which is what libertarians tend to do very well. It's I think, at the end of the day, and this is what I like about libertarians also, is that they tend to be the ones on my side on that scale.
Yeah.
They tend to, for instance, they'll talk about the United States. They won't say we. It's never we when they talk about the United States bombing Cambodia. It's the United States bombed Cambodia. When I heard libertarians say that, I knew I could hang out with them.
Yeah, well, you know, that this is one of the things Ron Paul said that really got me interested in all this. But when he would say, like, he said the first thing you have to get people to do is ask the most important question, which is, what is the role of government?
Yeah.
What the role of government ought to be?
Yeah.
And just asking that question, it's like, wow, that's so weird to me. That I literally, I mean, I made it through, you know, like, say, Berkeley Carroll, this, like, fancy high school, and no one ever posed this question to me. And I never even thought about it. And, like, I never even thought about, like, what is the state? What should the state be?
Mm-hmm.
What? And if you objectively look at it, it is, I mean, to me, the idea that there's, like, a few hundred people in Washington who are bought off by the military-industrial complex, who then make deals with their partner to send kids from, like, Flint, Michigan to go murder a whole bunch of people in some godforsaken third world country under some brutal dictator. It's like, okay, and then I'm going to say, we bombed that country? Like, that's insane. I mean, if you think it through, it's just, it's logically insane.
I know.
But the point you made also, I would say I talk about this a lot on my podcast, but I've really come to understand that more over the last year. And I guess this election helped, that the culture is where the entire battle is.
Mm-hmm.
And where I think I was being a little bit of an autistic libertarian for the years before that, where it's kind of like, well, no, as long as we abolish the income tax, I mean, that's really what matters. And you do realize, like as Andrew Breitbart said, it is a great quote, but politics is downstream from culture. You see this with Michael Malice made this point, but with the gay marriage issue, you see, as soon as it goes over 51% of people approve, all of a sudden all the Democrats fall into line. You're like, you're not leading us. Like, we're leading you.
Yeah. So I guess I was going to say this to you. You do political comedy, not all of your comedy is political, but you do more than most comics.
Sure.
And it's, you know, of course, libertarian. And I think that's all good, and don't stop it. But I think that's even that part of your comedy is not where you're actually influencing the culture in that way.
Hmm.
Not much, I would bet. You know who influenced the culture in a libertarian way is Richard Pryor, by saying by not being American.
Right.
Hmm. That's what he did, and many other comics have done it too, especially black comics, but also Jewish comics. You know, they would just speak in a way that was like, they seem to not care at all about the United States.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like,
I see what you're saying.
And so that's really common among African Americans for sort of obvious reasons, right? We don't feel like we belong to this thing.
Sure.
Which makes them another good model that libertarians totally ignore. Like, I say to them, you know, that if you look at draft resistance in the United States over the last 100 years, African Americans, like, way overrepresented, like,
sure,
like 30% of, you know, draft dodgers basically were black, but only 10% of the population.
I completely agree with you, and I think this is one area, I guess, where I sharply disagree with people on the alt-right, although I'm not as hostile to the alt-right as a lot of people are, but this is an area where I sharply disagree with them, and I thought Rand Paul, his campaign was like an utter disaster, and he really blew a very important moment, but that was one of the great things that he did. I mean, I thought that was really great when he started actually trying to reach out to the black community and be like, hey, there actually is something we can offer you, which is more important than what the Democrats can offer you, which is like, hey, we want to stop throwing people in cages when it's not necessary.
Yeah, and so again,
let's at least go with, like, when it's not necessary, let's stop doing
this. And I'm not talking about, people always get confused when I make this argument. They say, oh yeah, that's right, Martin Luther King was opposed to the Vietnam War. No, I'm not talking about Martin Luther King. I'm talking about the black people who get denounced for being shiftless, self-interested, you know, lazy Negroes in the streets. I'm talking about people who seem to live for themselves, and there was no evidence that they gave a shit about the United States of America or protecting it, or they felt like
probably hostile toward it.
Or hostile. Yeah. They just wanted it to leave them alone.
Sure, yeah.
See?
Which is excellent. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Right. No, look, I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, look, most of the civil rights movement is, I mean, a very libertarian struggle. I mean, it's like you said, it's a struggle for freedom and for the state to, you know, like, well, I mean, if you're talking about sort abolishing of. Jim Crow laws, or you're talking right. about, you know, I mean, this is like, so, and there's a reason why it was mostly a Republican backed movement. I mean, this is like, who, you know, it was kind of in line with the idea of natural rights and small government.
Yeah, it's just the civil rights movement, the first half of it.
Yes,
the,
well, this is
but even, desegregation, of course. But even by the libertarian, but then the next thing they did,
but
was
even by the 64
call for state mandated integration.
Right, but
yeah.
Everyone looks at the top, and Barry Goldwater did oppose it. But if you look at the Congress, I mean, it was mostly Republicans who backed even the mm-hmm. even the 64 civil rights bill. Yeah. So even at that point, even though that maybe went a step further than a lot of people wanted to, and I agree, is not in line with libertarianism mm-hmm. anymore. Overall, even that 64 bill, like 9/10 of it are pretty in line with libertarianism. It's just where they cross the line and go like, oh, now we have to regulate your business and who you can serve, which
yeah.
I think is an unnecessary step and does lead to bad things.
Yeah. I mean, I've said this many times, but like Richard Pryor is my original influence. And I mean, like in my scholarly work, because right. if you read my work, you'll see right away that I don't identify, at least as an author, as a thinker, as a historian, I don't identify at all with the United States or America in any of my writing. It's just, you can just sort of feel it
right.
in my writing, as opposed to most historians who basically they come at it with, well, how are we going to fix this problem that we have as a country?
Right, right.
I'm not
but
about
do you
that.
Think it's not, but do you think it's necessarily a bad thing to have any type, because I do tend to think, like, it seems to me, and this is what, like, in theory, I'd almost be like, let's get rid of, like, you know, organized religion or something like that. But then it seems like every time anyone abandons that, they go right into some other religion, which becomes like, you know, like social justice warrior or mm-hmm. statism or something like that. And I almost feel like maybe people do need these kind of collective ideas in their head. And like, do you think there's anything to being like, you know, like the 4th of July or something like that I was talking about on my show the other day. I go, I kind of like the idea of having a holiday where we celebrate independence and freedom. And I was talking about it. I was like, hey, let's like break up from the federal government. Let's secede. Like, I like the idea of secession and that. So I almost like, I like the idea. It's kind of a myth. It's not like really the history of America. But do you think there's something, like, is it negative if people just kind of have this like land of the free, home of the brave type of, like, you know, like, because yeah. I just don't know if you can strip that away from
because,
people.
Well, yes, because that very phrase has been used to justify every war.
Sure.
Ever, right?
No, I'm with you. I just don't, I think there's a very, like, natural thing in people where, like I was saying before, they want to go, like, my team's the best, my aunt makes the best chili, and my, like, everyone's got to have this thing. And there is, like, I mean, as you said, the American identity, it is very strong.
Mm-hmm. Like, I know. It sort of lies dormant all the time, mm-hmm. or most of the time, right? It's not like people run around talking about America on the streets all the time. But when they're asked in one way or another, either in a poll or when we're told that North Korea is a threat to us, did you see the polls on North Korea? Yeah. It went from, like, what was it, 20% of Americans thought that North Korea was a threat to us, to 64% yesterday.
I couldn't believe it.
And they're ready to go to war.
It's unbelievable.
That's basically the United States people, the American people, pushing the button. Or saying to Trump, go ahead, push the 64% so that North Korea constitutes a threat, an existential threat to the United States of America here. Well, that's it. I mean, he's got it. That's what Franklin Roosevelt, wanted all the way through the 1930s, but couldn't get during isolationism, right? Because yeah. Americans were like, fuck, no, we're not going back to war in Europe. And he desperately wanted it, but he couldn't get it until, guess when? Pearl Harbor.
And then,
but that was it. Right. And then as soon as he got the public behind this, he was off and running. So,
and you see that the same way with, like, the neocons wanted to get this Patriot Act in. They wanted the war in Iraq. Yeah. They wanted all these things. And then they get 9/11. And then they're like, okay, now we've got the public support behind it.
Weapons of mass destruction. They
it's
needed
like,
that.
For all the talk of, like, how war weary we are and how, you know, the thing that really crushed me with that, because I really thought the anti-war movement was making a lot of progress. And when we initially shut down the war in Syria, I thought that they all say something we about it.
Me
when
too.
I was like, oh man, this is really turning the tide. Like, they can't get this war. And then they literally ended up, like, they were selling you on Assad being the bad guy to get the war they wanted. And then they just went like, oh no, how about ISIS as the bad guys? And then they went in and then they get the war. They still get it.
When you said we shut that down, you meant people in the streets marching
against
Obama and sending missiles. Yeah.
Online and stuff. Sure. All that stuff where people, the soldiers who were sending in full uniform but their face blurred out, they go, I will not fight with Al-Qaeda mm-hmm. in Syria.
It was a great
moment. That was incredible.
Yeah, I was in the streets in LA and there was a lot of marches and a lot of activism online and, you know, in the streets. And I said at the time, and I still think it's basically true, I think that did stop Obama from doing it. From pulling the trigger.
It absolutely stopped that round of the war. There's no question. They were going in for regime change. And by the way, maybe it stopped regime change, which is, I mean, dude, of all the crazy positions, the fact that all of the war hawk neocons, I use that term a little bit sloppily, but all of the war hawk Republicans who I, you know, I interact with fairly regularly, they all think the big mistake is that we didn't overthrow Assad in that window.
Yeah.
And you're like, are you out of your fucking mind?
It's okay.
I'm sorry, I'm not supposed to curse.
Please.
Away. Yeah, I'm not talking about this. It's not a process podcast. I'm just used to, like, this isn't Tom Woods. But like, it's like you really look at Saddam being overthrown, Gaddafi being overthrown, and go, man, we should have gotten another one. And you know what I'll tell you is uniquely different about Syria than those other things? Like, it would have been very hard to predict that Al-Qaeda was going to rise up in Iraq, or that that ISIS would form. It was kind of hard to predict what would happen after Gaddafi. It's easy to see what's going to happen in Syria if Assad overthrows. That's ISIS. Oh, that's ISIS's country now.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, yeah. It hasn't worked out very well, but they don't get the lesson. Here's the good news for them, though. It's okay. You don't have to worry about your neocon friends anymore. They just established a think tank with Hillary Clinton and her people, the Clintonites. You know about this? There's a new think tank that's going to be neocons and Democrats who basically want to do regime change around the world.
Which has always kind of been the case anyway. I mean, it's that whole group of Hillary Clinton Democrats are essentially neocons on foreign policy. They're right there with them.
Speaking of war and Park Slope, Brooklyn, I was living in Park Slope on September 11th.
Oh, really?
2001. And that day, as you know, there was not a single American flag in that neighborhood. You did not see an American flag.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been worse than corny to have an American flag on your stoop in Park Slope, right?
Oh, yeah.
And worse than corny to be talking about America in your conversations at the cafe with the mom in the yoga pants, taking their kids to 321. The public school there, which my son went to.
I used to play basketball in that yard every day of my
life.
Did
you go to 321?
No, but no. I lived there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. But on September 12th, there were flags all over that neighborhood on every stoop coming out of every car. And that was when these really good liberals, college-educated liberals, who thought Bush was the devil the day before and Giuliani was the double devil the day before, they were talking about Rudy and George being really good.
They became gods.
They were going to be our protectors. But so you didn't.
And Rudy Giuliani, it was such an emotional thing. It was like for being there. There was nothing. He did nothing. He just kind of came down and was like, this is a tragedy.
No, he did. I mean, he like quadrupled the cops in the streets.
Okay, sure. Yeah, okay, sure. So
he's created the New York that you
which he had already did, which he had already been doing.
He created the New York that you now live in, which is a police state almost. I mean,
yes, but that was going on already.
In terms of at least surveillance.
Pre-9/11, he was doing that. I mean, that he did a lot of that in the late 90s. But after 9/11, he came down to the rubble and was like, this is terrible. And everyone's like, mayor hero. It's like.
But right after that, he gets federal funding.
Of course.
And ramps
up,
you know, so now there's just a cop on every block and there's cameras everywhere.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's something else. But so I want to go back to, you know, you, nice Jewish boy from Park Slope, Brooklyn, the liberal capital of the East Coast, at least, right? And it was then, even when you were growing up. So you grew up in the, 80s and 90s?
Yep, born in 83.
Okay.
And yeah.
So how disappointed are your parents in you?
You know, not too bad. I don't have a relationship with my father. Huh. So he's not in the picture. My mother is, she was always like left leaning. Like we're Jews from New York. So there's no other,
choice.
Murray Rothbard said when he was in the 40s, he said as a Jew in New York, it was, the debate was, should you be like a card carrying communist or a communist who isn't a card-carrying communist? Like, which way did you want to go? Those were your two options.
Well, no, it was that, and it was also whether you're going to be in the Communist Party or you were going to be a Trotskyist. That was those were your only choices.
So you're different man. Brands of Marxism.
So my parents were Trotskyists, and they came out of, they weren't here, but they came out. There was a tendency, it was called the Left Shakmanites, who were the Trotskyists who, these are anti-Stalinists, anti-communists, right? And also they became anti-war. And so they were not bad as hardcore revolutionaries.
They're the better ones. Yes.
If you're going to have a conversation, they're ones you might be able to have a conversation with. But the Shakmanites, his name was Max Shakman, and Rothbard knew him and knew all about him. Same time, same people, community, City College and all that crew uptown. The Shackmanites split over the Vietnam War. So the Shackmanites who thought the United States should intervene in Vietnam were called the Right Shackmanites. And those who opposed it were called the Left Shackmanites. Left Shackmanites went around the country, and one faction went to Berkeley, California. And that was where my parents, and that's where I was born because of that, essentially.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then the Right Shackmanites, I don't know if you know this, they became...
The neocons?
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. No, I know. I've read a bunch of like Irving Kristol stuff and what's his name? Podhurst. And
Podhoritz.
Like, Podhoritz. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying that all wrong. Actually, I met his son.
John Podhoritz,
who's the editor at
Commentary.
Commentary, yeah. Yeah, no, so I know a little bit about those guys' whole thing. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I got to actually say, I think in a lot of ways, like even today, the comparisons between like Marxists and neocons, there's still a lot of similarities.
Sure.
I mean, it's really unbelievable how, look, essentially what our military does over there is become a socialist government. Like when we took over, like after Saddam falls, our military is now the socialist government of Iraq. And it's also, look, if you look at the way neocons talk about the Middle East, it's pretty much like you got to break some eggs to make an omelet, but you never get the omelet.
Absolutely.
It's kind of the same problem as communism. It's like you keep justifying this, like, oh, well, we need to do this to get this grand picture. And then at the end you go, oh, we didn't get any grand picture. Mm-hmm. We just murdered a whole bunch of people.
Yeah. I would imagine your mom is okay with that part of you that says this stuff.
Well, I'll tell you, though, my mother's gotten a lot better. Here's what happened to my mother, right? My mother was is a psychoanalyst.
So is mine.
Interesting. Okay. Uh-huh. So she, now my mother, when I was a kid growing up in Brooklyn in the
90s. A Jewish psychoanalyst, my mother, by the way.
Oh, mm-hmm. Really? Oh, yes. That. Okay.
Oh, yes.
So now growing up in the 90s, my mother was broke, and she was putting herself through school when I was young. And then she took a job at a Presbyterian hospital in Washington Heights.
Mm-hmm.
And she was basically, I mean, it's just like the most brutal job ever. She was in the child psychology ward or whatever. So she would basically be like, she'd be the person evaluating whether the state should come take your kids away from you
because
you were such a god-awful abusive parent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a brutal job, and made like very little money doing it. Really, really tough job. So that's where, and then she, like, maybe in the late 90s, she started a private practice. Like right now she's doing very good. She's got a private practice. She's making six figures and she's doing... And I think that as she worked very, very hard to get up to the level of success and is now paying over 50% in taxes for this ridiculously, but like she's actually coming around much more. She's not a libertarian at all, but is certainly coming around much more to the idea that these are a bunch of crooks who are robbing her and giving, and she gets nothing for it. You know,
has she ever told you why she became a psychologist or a psychoanalyst?
We've talked about it a little bit. I think her first inclination was she wanted to be a medical doctor. And I forget exactly what it was. I feel like it was a long time ago, but she changed her mind and decided to go into psychology.
But I mean, like a deeper psychological motivation to do this. So I'll tell you what my mother said to me. She said, I chose to do this because I care about people. So...
No, I don't think my mother said that, but she said things like, my mother's always said she thinks the highest meaning in life is to live for other people.
Oh, well.
And so I think that's probably...
That's the same thing.
Yeah,
that's what my mother meant. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's definitely like, I guess she has that same quality.
And guess what people on the left say about libertarians? They don't care about people.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable to me. I've always found this. I got... So I was on Duncan Trussell's podcast, who's a great guy, really hilarious comedian. And I was talking to him all about libertarianism, like what I believe and why I'm a libertarian. And he hadn't really heard a lot of the arguments before, and he found a lot of them very interesting. He was like, oh man, that's right. And I remember he asked me at one point, and it really stuck with me, but he was like, okay, so I get what you're saying. We're talking about healthcare, but he's like, but just like in a libertarian world, if there was like a surgeon and then there was someone like dying who needed him, you would want that guy to treat him, right? And I was like, yeah, of course. You know, like, but it's interesting to me that you have to ask that question. And then when I said to him, he really liked the answer. But I said, like, yeah, of course I want that guy to treat him. And my point is that I don't think, absent a law, this guy who went into medicine, like, would just be like, ha, die in the street. Because that's why I went into medicine, to watch somebody die in front of me. And then he was like, oh, okay, that. But it is very interesting to me that that is the thing. That is the this one moment really I've talked about on my show really stood out to me, and it was years ago. This is before Bernie Sanders made his presidential run and everyone knew about it. People like us just knew him, you know, like people who weren't into politics didn't care about Bernie Sanders. But he was on Hardball with Chris Matthews in 2012 when Ron Paul was in the campaign, and they played a clip of Ron Paul where they were like, so what do you think if someone doesn't have insurance and they get in an accident? Shouldn't the government step in? And Ron Paul was like, that's what freedom's all about. You know, mm-hmm. you take your risks and now you have to live with it. And Bernie Sanders goes, look, Ron Paul's an honest guy, but this is what he believes. Mm-hmm. This is what libertarians believe. If you don't have health care, you should die. And you take a step back and you go, oh, hey, just so you guys know, Ron Paul is a doctor who worked in a Christian hospital for $1 an hour and they didn't turn anybody away. Bernie Sanders is just a politician. He's just sitting here, like, he's never provided healthcare for anyone in his fucking life. And he has the nerve to tell Ron Paul, a guy who you could find testimonials of people who he's treated for free. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just insanity.
Yeah, so this deeply held assumption, which again, I think it's part of Americans' identity. It's also part of many Europeans' identity, mm-hmm. that if you believe the state shouldn't care for people, take care of people, then you don't care about people, yes. right? So that's that, right? I'm sure this is the world you are struggling against all day, every
constantly,
day, right?
Yes.
They just, this assumption, it's more than an assumption. It's like, it's just part of their DNA, right? That's actually only about 60 years old among Americans,
right?
Meaning like this part of the cultural fabric of this country, right? You're almost born into that just belief. It's World War II. So before World War II, you don't find many Americans talking like that. Some, for sure.
Right.
The progressives and socialists and, you know, a handful of, you know, Democrats. But even Democratic Party didn't talk like that. And that changes with World War II because they had to justify this war that in this place that no one wanted to go to a minute ago, you know, in countries that they had never heard of. So they made it into a moral war, right? And it became the great moral war. Right. It still is. This is the one war, right? Americans as dumb.
And it's the one you can't poke holes in the narrative or you're going to get in a lot of trouble.
As ignorant as Americans are about politics and especially foreign policy, right? At least I can say this for them. Every war except World War II, they're at least skeptical about right now. Mm-hmm. You know, Vietnam, World War I, Korea, all those things. Except for World War II, that's still the moral war. So that was a planned propaganda campaign. The federal government hired all these anthropologists and they wrote books and they convinced them, put it in the school curriculums, and they convinced Americans that, you know, the Nazi regime was absolutely evil, which, sure.
It was not the hardest sell.
No, right, exactly. So the Nazis gave them this great opportunity. So it's like, here's the thing, guys. But it's not just, we need to motivate all these kids from Kansas to go to Germany and fight and die for something that really isn't going to affect them.
It's amazing how much World War II is like, it is like the church of, it's at the center of like the religion of American military. Like, mm-hmm. so if you even like, you know, whatever it is today for some war, you know, like they'll get in, there's the same thing they hit Ron Paul with all the time, but it's going like, oh, you're being, if you don't want to get in some war in the Middle East, you're being Chamberlain in the 30s. You wouldn't have fought that one war. You can't argue against that war. Right. And that, you know, you could be anti-Vietnam, you could be anti all these other wars, but you have to be, I mean, if you're anti-World War II, you got to leave that network. Like, you can't challenge that one. I'm almost interested in your take on that, because I think a lot of people on the right today fairly point out, and I think this is a very interesting theme, that, like, the crimes of the communists are largely ignored. Oh, and, yeah. and, like, to a point that's really, yeah. really crazy. Like, yeah. it's really hard to sit back and you go, like, okay, so, like, Richard Spencer can sit, you know, if he has five people in his crowd who give a Nazi sign, mm-hmm. this is like the worst thing that's ever happened anywhere. Now, this is a guy who can't get into any mainstream right mm-hmm. world. I mean, he can only be on the absolute fringes,
yep.
that he could never be at a university or something like that. But then, like, a professor can just be a Marxist professor. Like, you can just be Colin Kaepernick can just put Fidel Castro on his shirt, and now he's like wondering why the Miami Dolphins are hesitant to take him. And you're like, well, dude, look, man, a lot of these Cubans don't have such a favorable view of him.
Yeah, to be against mass incarceration and have Fidel Castro on your shirt.
I mean, come on, man.
Kind of a contradiction, Colin.
Yes, but I do think, now I think a lot of it seems to be very convenient that it's like, okay, they're. Whatever you want to call, like, you know, as you were saying before we started recording, like, some of these terms get used rather sloppily, mm-hmm. and I'm guilty of that too. But, like, if you want to say, like, cultural Marxism or some Frankfurt, you know, like influence or any, like, Marxist influence, okay, well, it would make sense why they don't want to have the crimes of Marxist regimes out there in the public as much as their enemies. But I also think a lot of what you were talking about, it's really that like World War II has to stay as this glorious war. And if you start to realize that we partnered up with a guy who killed substantially more people than Hitler, it doesn't sell quite as well as like this was such a great war.
Yeah. So I'm writing a book, which is a history of American foreign relations. So it's both the foreign policy stuff, the wars, but it's also about American popular culture spreading around the world and being this liberating, for the most part, and subversive influence everywhere, starting in the 19th century in the Philippines and the spread of jazz and Hollywood and blue jeans and all that over the last century and a half. And, you know,
it's a fascinating topic.
It's taken me a while too. I've been working on the book for 7 years. And when I got in the narrative to World War II, you know, it's only two chapters I'm devoting to World War II, but they're long, but it's, I've been working on those chapters for 2 years, just two chapters, because two reasons. One is that I realized that this is the nut to crack. This is the last nut that isn't to crack. It is so hard, and you have to be, the argument has to be airtight, but it is all there. I am now completely convinced, and this is a fairly new thing for me, completely convinced that the intervention, the U.S. intervention, Western intervention in World War II killed way, way, way more people
than it saved.
Than it saved. Yeah. So that if the United States had not intervened, I'm pretty much convinced that there would have been maybe 5% at most of the casualties. Oh, and here's the other thing. I'm sure you know about this. Speaking of Jews, the United States closed its borders to the Jewish refugees repeatedly over and over
again. Very, very well known in my Jewish family. I mean, they do not forget that at all. We didn't save Jews. You know, I mean, like, there were like we saved like the last few hundred of them or something. I mean, like, it's it's not as if we intervened to stop a genocide. Like, a genocide happened.
So the title of my chapter on the Holocaust is called Saving the Dead, because they were all dead.
Yeah.
Because Roosevelt's policies actually guaranteed the Holocaust, didn't cause it, but guaranteed that it would happen.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And it's like, it's so frustrating, man, but I was on I did two news panels the other day, and it's like every conservative is like celebrating that Trump is talking tough with North Korea. And it's like, I remember this with George W. Bush. I remember them all, like, they love this tough guy language that's like, we'll get him dead or alive and we'll do that. And then it's like, oh, oops, you know, 300,000 dead people in a nation destroyed. You know, it's like, okay, tough talk is utterly retarded. Like, you're dealing with a guy in North Korea it's essentially a hostage situation.
Yeah.
And a guy's got nukes. Mm-hmm. And he's holding millions of people hostage with these nukes. And your response to that is to be like, hey, you suck, queer. Like, dude, don't start cursing this guy. Like, what are you doing, man?
Yeah.
Like, that's the worst thing you could... If you're going to make a move. Don't sit here and start being like, I bet you got a little dick.
Yeah.
How about that? I bet you wouldn't even drop that bomb. Like, Jesus, man.
As bad as that is, Trump, the sort of Trump, McCain, bellicose, stupid, masculine, right, go to war because of our national pride, et cetera, thing. As bad as that is, and it's basically mass murder, there's no doubt about it, and I'm worried all the time about that with Trump, although less and less so these days. But anyway, it is, the whole argument that I make is that that, as bad as it is far less dangerous and historically has killed just a fraction of what people with really strong ideas have killed. The people with the grand plans for remaking the world, which has been going on for more than 100 years, right? Remaking the world in our image.
Yeah.
The ones who come out of Harvard and Columbia. Every war, every single war and military conflict in this country's history, the idea came from professors. Every single one. Intellectuals and professors, every single one. It's not the military who comes up with these ideas. It's not ordinary Americans. Of course not, because Americans don't know shit about other countries. It has to be a professor who actually reads the books and studies the maps. Look at every one of them. The ideas were hatched in Ivy League universities. And so they're the ones who launched the Spanish-American War, the American Empire, World War I, World War II, and they wanted that war from the get-go, and they just did everything they could to set it up so that we would go to war, the United States would go to war.
It's
Korea,
so
Vietnam, very famously, right? The best and the brightest. You know this book, David Halberstam, about, it's all Harvard. There's all these super smart Harvard professors. That was their idea to escalate that war, to create that war. Iraq, who's Paul Wolfowitz? Professor, University of Chicago. Not the Ivy League, but the same thing, essentially, right? Crystal, all those guys, they're all egghead intellectuals like me. It's almost made me anti-intellectual, but not quite.
It's amazing how much that class can be poisoned.
Yeah.
I mean, you would think, like, this is, it's like, how are there so few? that step up.
Yeah.
Like, how are there so few of yous? Like, how is, like, every intellectual not like, no, I can't be in this environment. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, that's why Trump's non-intellectualism and anti-intellectualism has been sort of useful, at least rhetorically, in many ways, right? Because that was his whole thing. Was like, I don't know. Is it our duty to go regime change around the world? You know, this is sort of Bannon and Stephen Miller's thing, mm-hmm. right? When Trump is actually saying good things about foreign policy, it's that. It's kind of like, who cares? You know, he's sort of anti-intellectual in that way.
It's amazing how much they poisoned. That was really interesting to me, was the thing with Bannon, where overnight he became every person I know who's on the left's mortal enemy. He became he was worse than Trump all mm-hmm. of a sudden. I mean, they had just met him. I know these people. They've never read his stuff. Never. Mm-hmm. And I had been reading his stuff because, you know, I'm like kind of out on the right wing and I'm interested in what a pop right wing movement is doing. So I'm paying attention to Breitbart. And then they're like, in a day, they're convinced he's like this racist guy and he's the most evil thing ever. He's the worst part of Trump. And I'm like, guys, he's against the war in Syria, and this is why the entire media has turned on him. It's like not that crazy of a conspiracy. Like they were systematically going against everyone who was against the war in Syria. I know KT McFarland told me a fucking year and a half ago that she didn't want to go to war in Syria, and in the same week that like Flynn has to resign, she has to resign, Bannon has to step out of the National Security Council. Like, no, I'm sorry, this is about and then the next week we bomb Syria. So like, no, I'm sorry. And how easy they're able to convince all my left-wing people. Like, they all become useful idiots if, like, racism is uttered. Or, like, like all you have to do is be like, one guy's transphobic. And they're like, well, everyone, look over here. That, you know, forget this.
So did your Park Slope people, your family, your mom freak out about Trump? Like, people really close to you?
My sister was big Hillary, a big Hillary supporter, mm-hmm. which is just, you know, we don't even really talk politics.
But also freaking out about Trump in
yes,
this way.
Yes, was
so,
freaked out about
Trump. And you were coming along, not being pro-Trump, but being...
No, I was anti-Trump the whole time. I was hoping...
But in the wrong way, right?
Not in the way... To them in the wrong way, I'm sure. No, I think it's like... I don't know what's happened to the left. I think it's like... What's gone on with them in the last 10 years is it's like you could make any of the, you know, if you want to draw a line to like the Frankfurt School or to postmodernism or to any other, you know, like Marxism or any of this stuff, it's like whatever's happened in the last 10 years, it's gone into a funhouse mirror and is now just like this it's so cartoonish. Yeah. But I thought that Meryl Streep summed it up perfectly when she said, do you remember at the Oscars? She gave that speech and she said, it was the moment when he made fun of a disabled journalist. So and it was a moment about bullying. And to them, this is like the great offense of like if you had to look at something, this was the moment he made fun of a guy's weird arm. Now, okay, that was utterly immature and nasty and like a shitty thing to do. But like, I don't know. The guy's an adult. Mm-hmm. He has this arm. I'm going to go ahead and assume he's probably come to terms with this. He survived middle school, and he's not such a weak human being that he's crushed by someone making fun of him. And she actually says, Meryl Streep says in this thing, this is the left-wing narrative, she goes, Donald Trump made fun of a man who he outranked in privilege and status, a man with no voice of his own.
Mm-hmm.
The guy was a fucking journalist. He does not have no voice of his own.
Oh, I know.
Like, you just made him powerless, you asshole.
Well, no, it's all about, you know, this is not who I would want at my house for a dinner party.
It's like, okay, fine.
So this is the thing, Dave. This is the thing, Dave. So the liberals and leftists in this country, not all of them, but overwhelmingly, I'd safely say more than 90% of leftists and liberals in this country are at least middle class.
Yes.
Which means that they have never been invaded by a foreign power. They've never been to war. They probably don't even know anyone who's been in a war, right? So that stuff is all abstract to them. They don't care that much about it. They didn't cross the border from Mexico ever. Their housekeeper did. They probably feel sort of bad for her.
Yeah.
But they've never actually experienced that. It's not a threat to them, right? So they can only sort of, you know, project ideas onto immigrants and, you know, brown people.
Well, that's right.
They've never been in prison.
And
they know no one. They don't know anyone who's been in prison. They also can afford to pay those huge taxes to fund those people.
Doesn't
they sort of
like
feel bad about.
Deal,
you know what I mean? So there's no personal experience with any of the things that you and I are talking about.
I think you're right. And also, I think they haven't seen poor white people. You know, they're around their own group of white people who are living their lives.
Yeah.
They haven't been to a trailer park. So the idea of white privilege kind of, not to say that there's nothing to that, but like it rings perfectly true to them. It's like, oh yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, like if you meet some really poor white people, that challenges that narrative a little bit.
Yeah. they have no personal experience with what you and I are talking about.
Right.
So ask a person who's been in the military or who is currently in the military about Syria, and then ask about what should be done about Syria, and then ask Meryl Streep about what should be done in Syria. I don't know what her position is, but I'll bet you anything that she is way, way, way more likely to send that kid in the Marines to Syria than
just
he,
as long as
than
no one
he
says
is,
mean things.
Than he wants to go.
Yeah.
Right? So
no, you're absolutely right.
It's that. So therefore, it's politics for them is largely, I'm explaining this, I think, is largely cultural and aesthetic. It's really aesthetic.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It's that level. So that's why Trump's character, his manner of speech, the particular words he uses, his ties, his hair, his sexuality, which freaks them out more than anything, his, you know, the fact that he displays his wealth, which you're not supposed to do in this society, right? Unless you're a hip hopper.
But that's it. But it's this thing.
That freaks them out more than anything.
I really think, yes, I think you're 100% right. And I think the thing is, I got to say, I think the thing about Trump is that he does not speak in their PC language. He's an absolute threat to their PC language, and he's an unapologetic white male. But I think being an unapologetic white male is something you cannot be on the left. It's like you can be a white male and be in, but you have to constantly be being told about that you have this privilege that other people, you have to agree. Yes, I know I have, like you kind of have to be down here, and then you can be a left-wing white male today. You can't like stand up, have your chest out, and be like, I'm a man, this is what I think, this is what they look. I hear myself say this, and I sound like I can't believe I'm ever saying this. But it's just at the core of this culture, left-wing ideology is hostility toward white men, toward Western society, toward capitalism in general. It's like at every turn, that's always seems to be what like left-wing people today are trying to bash.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm not totally there with that, but I'm pretty close to it, or at least I agree with part of that for sure, which is ask. Find me a poor person in this country, or even just a ordinary working class person in this country, who thinks that consumerism is bad.
Well, that's right.
You won't.
I used to have a bit about this.
You cannot find one
in my comedy act. I used to do a bit about this literally, where I'd say I was like, if you hate capitalism, like that's fine, that's your opinion, but just know that that's a privileged opinion. Mm-hmm. That only rich people from rich countries feel that way.
Correct.
Like you may walk down Times Square and be like, oh my God, the consumerism in the car. I go, no one from Central Africa comes to Times Square and goes, ugh, the consumerism. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, food. Look at all this food. Like, you're 100% right.
Because they're guaranteed to still have their latte tomorrow.
Right.
That's the thing. Again, they have no personal experience with poverty.
It's crazy.
They're
the ones who actually need to check their privilege.
They made up this
slogan, and it applies to them.
So it's all abstract. It's all these things that you and I are talking about are all about other people. They only talk about other people when they talk about politics. So there's nothing there. They have no skin in any of these games.
I think that's it. And I think there's an intense guilt that comes along that I think we all have, right? Like, I think there's this thing about our relative privilege. And even if you're not like as aware of it as like someone like you might be, because you're like really live in trying to understand history, and most people don't live in that world. But you go like, oh, there's been like all of human history, and we are so fucking lucky in terms of the amount of wealth, the standard of life that we're living at.
Sure.
We're like up here, and we didn't really earn it. It's really these generations who put in like really, really hard labor, who like kind of built this up for us. And then you'll just walk through your day, like me and you, like this is our life. This is like what we get to do. Like it just you know, like meet someone who you've like listened to on podcasts. Mm-hmm. I've heard you on these shows, and now I get to come have a conversation with you. And then I'm going to do a stand-up comedy set tonight, and like probably have lunch with my girlfriend in between. Like that's my life.
Yep.
And then I'll just pass by somebody else on the way there whose life is like, you know, like you were saying before, that liberals, you know, housekeeper, and they're right there with someone else whose life like fucking sucks. Then I'll just pass by like at lunch, and there's like some guy who's older than me who will come wipe my table off. And you're kind of like, I kind of have this much nicer life, and you have this at least materially speaking, mm-hmm. like, you know what I mean? Like a shittier life. I didn't really deserve this. It's an uncomfortable thing. And I think this is a lot of times what drives this left wing. Like I have to virtue signal and lecture about privilege to kind of overcompensate for my own feeling. But I'm just saying it turns into hostility toward white people when you'll just see like, look, they'll criticize. If it's Christians, they'll talk about how oppressive they are to women. Mm-hmm. Not a word on Muslims. When it's, if it's white comedians, well, they'll go after you. You turn on Huffington Post or Jezebel, they'll write articles about some of my friends, or white male stand-up comedian uses sexist language. Not a word about hip-hop music. Mm-hmm. Not a word. Yeah. Which is like
exactly.
way yeah. more of a culprit than that same, because they can't. Now, homophobia is a huge conversation, but when black people come out and shut down the right for gay marriage in California, not a word. Because it seems to me modern left, it's like they want to criticize white people. Mm-hmm. And if it's not doing that, then they're not virtue signaling about how they're the good ones.
Believe it or not, this all goes back to World War II as well. This is all explained there, because as I said, they had to mobilize the morality of this country to go to that war, right? Americans didn't want to do it. They just didn't want to do it. They'd just been out of
Which makes sense. The Great War.
Yeah, yeah. And it just didn't affect them. Hitler, as horrible as he was not coming over here ever. Roosevelt straight up lied about it.
Oh, yeah.
But nonetheless, even when he lied about it, Americans just totally didn't listen to him. So they had to mobilize change American morality. I don't mean in just for a moment. It stuck. So, and the central part of that morality, of course, was anti-racism, because that's what the Nazis became. Right. I mean, in the popular consciousness, of course they were racist, but no one cared until then. This justified fighting and dying in huge numbers. It's amazing what they pulled off. And I don't actually, at the end of the day, I don't really blame the Roosevelt administration. It was the fucking American people who bought this and have continued to buy it generally. So it's become part of the cultural DNA of our country. So if you are not clearly, fully anti-racist in even in appearance.
Right.
Here's the thing. Shelby Steele, do you know this guy? He's a black
Sounds
conservative.
Very familiar.
He was a very prominent black conservative about 30 years ago.
Okay.
He's Hoover Institution. He's still around. He's not doing a lot. But anyway, he has a book, and he made this argument that he made in the book about Trump. What happened was racist America of old, of segregation of, you know, and before World War II as well, became this source of object of shame for Americans, right? And so the idea was you have to, his argument is that liberals are deathly afraid of ever being associated with old America, that old America. So even the way you look, even in the way you talk, if you're ever associated in any way with Bull Connor or anybody from that old America, you are bad. And that's become just a central part of who we are. We just assume that. And so it actually,
it's really interesting.
Believe it or not, I really think I'm writing this now. It's this moral shift at the turn of the 20th century because of World War II that is the origin of that thinking.
Very interesting. And that really is,
you can't look like old America, and Trump looks totally like old America.
That's right.
Archie Bunker.
Yeah. And then there's like, you know, it's, you know, I always really did that Make America Great Again.
There you go.
Is one of the most brilliant political slogans. And I know it wasn't his originally. I know other people
use
that.
Steele's point.
Yes.
When liberals saw that, they're like, oh, that means going back to racism.
Right. It's so frustrating to them.
Did Trump have the idea that he wanted to go back to segregation? I don't think so. But, you know, whatever's in it.
I also thought.
But that was it.
There was something that the left couldn't acknowledge in this campaign that I found so interesting, where it's like, Trump would be like at his rallies, and he would say things like, huge, huge rallies, you know, 10,000 people, 20,000 people at these rallies. And he'd say things like, he'd go, you know, they say we're racist, the media, they're the biggest liars. When we get in there, we're going to be tremendous for the African-American people. And he'd get like a huge round of applause. And it's like, damn it, you can't ignore that. Like, I'm not saying you can't still be a racist person, but Trump is telling his people, they say we're racist, but we're not. We're going to help black people. And it gets a huge round of applause. These are not, I'm sorry. My grandfather was a Jew in Nazi Germany. I know what it is to be, like, I'm not saying I know what it is, but like, this is not exactly overt racism. Like, to make it out like this is a Nazi rise. No, he's actually saying the opposite, and it's drawing applause. Like, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. How can you just ignore that if your whole thing is that? And there'd be this constant thing. It's like, no, so that's not exactly what it is. It's not that he's being racist. It's more like what you were saying, that he, you know, like the old America isn't just that. Mm-hmm. It's not just that we had Jim Crow and slavery. There's other things, too,
so
that people are pining for.
Before World War II, and this is, you can just trace it, you know, it was perfectly acceptable to use the word nigger.
Yes.
And not in the way that I just used it. Right.
Right.
Totally fine. And you could talk about Jews, and I mean, the anti-Semitism before World War II. I mean, everybody was anti-Semitic in this country. And just really casually. It was no big deal. Like, they weren't calling for pogroms, but they were just, you know, the Jew, that those Jewish folks down the road, you know, they have all the money, and that's the problem with them. Very, very common and casual, totally respectable. World War II changed all of that. So in the 50s, that all those words, that way of thinking, that way of talking became completely verboten. to use a phrase, but so, and that stuck with us, right? So if you use that kind of language casually without any apparent shame, and that's really what Trump's doing, right? It's the shamelessness.
Yeah.
He doesn't care. Yeah. That's the problem. If he, you know, immediately apologized or, you know, let it slip and then clearly, oh my God, that was a mistake, that would be one thing, but he doesn't care. He unabashedly is of old America, at least aesthetically. And again, it's just aesthetics. If he's about the policies of old America, then I'm with the resistance, you know, right? But no, it's just the aesthetic. It's all aesthetic because these people have no skin in the game. They have no experience with these things, right? So it's just about decorations in your house. And the decorations in your house can't be, you know, pictures of mammies, you know, selling pancakes.
Right.
They have to be the new multicultural, anti-racist America. It's all aesthetic, and that's why he's like the worst piece of furniture you could ever put in your house.
It's interesting how he can challenge all of those things without actually. It just seems to me like there's never any, like, the most terrible things that Donald Trump's done as president are the things that he's continuing, that Obama did, that Bush did, that so it's not, and they don't like that. They don't want to go after one of those. Like, they can't go after Trump for the drone bombs, because then you got to look at, you know, I have heard a couple left-wing people who go, do you know he stepped up the number of drone attacks? And you're like, right. And you made a lot of noise about that in 2009, right? So I'm fine. Like, come over here and be with me. But you got to kind of admit the last guy stepped up drone strikes, like, you know, pretty heavily.
Drone strikes, I'm not even sure that's true. The data is not clear at all.
That's the other side.
Casualties, it looks like, we don't know because no one knows for sure, but the casualties might have increased in the last 6 months. But almost entirely because of the attack, the invasion of Mosul, which Obama's project.
Exactly.
That was the mission laid out by Obama.
Right. Okay. And no, it seems that Trump is, as much as he would never want to say it this way, but they seem to more or less be following a continuation of the Obama foreign policy, which is basically the same place. He's basically in the same place that Obama was in the fact that, like, I don't think I have the popular opinion to send ground troops into one of these wars, but we're going to continue to what is essentially the Obama doctrine. Was that, which is this is really new and terrifying. The Obama doctrine was, I will bomb whatever country I want, whenever I want. We are at war with the globe permanently. Mm-hmm. And I basically have thrown out the Constitution, thrown out the War Powers Act, thrown out any of that, even the pretense of there's anything I need to go through before I go bomb a country. And these fucking people who are so goddamn ignorant, who say, they go, no, well, you know what's great about the drone wars, now we don't have to send in troops. You're like, okay, do you think it was possible that bribing the poor kids in America who are on their fourth and fifth tour right now, you think Obama could have sent ground troops into Yemen, Libya, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan? Like, you think he could have, like, managed a force for every one of these countries? I know I've left a few off there. Yemen, like, everyone that he drone bombed? No, he couldn't have done that. He wouldn't have bombed them.
Yeah.
We just wouldn't have done this.
So this executive power, this unilateral executive power to make war in other countries that Obama used and expanded. So the argument for that, the intellectual argument for that, and the putting into practice of it was the Roosevelt administration, Franklin again, Truman and Johnson. I mean, this is not debated among historians.
No, this is the legal president.
We know
right?
this. But I'm saying their advisors were also making arguments. They were writing papers. They were writing articles. They were giving speeches saying this. Look, we live in a dangerous world. There are Nazis in this world. There are communists in this world. The problem is the American people. They actually said this. You can look it up. All those advisors said, the problem is that we live in a democracy, and the American people usually don't want to go to these wars because they don't know anything about those countries. But we know that we must protect America, and we must really save the world. But we're stopped by these democratic people, small d, with their votes. So that's why the president needs to go his own way with foreign policy. The origins of what people are freaking out about now are with those guys. So here's the big proof for why these liberals don't really care about policies and it's only aesthetic. What was the biggest outrage about Trump during the campaign and just after the election? What were people really freaking out about the most?
Through the whole election season, what was the pussy, the grab him by the pussy tape, and the Mexican comments that were the ones that I heard.
Well, the wall, right?
Right, right.
Immigration generally.
Yeah, yeah. That stuff. When he first came out with they're sending the rapists, they're not sending their best or whatever, that was right
yeah,
away.
Yeah, so I lived in downtown LA during that time, right after the election, and there were probably a million people in downtown LA the next day. I mean, yeah. And it was almost all immigrants and immigrant supporters. It was almost entirely about immigration. You remember, right? Yeah. He was going to deport all the Mexicans in the country, legal and illegal. Absolute freak out. And he's the worst person in the world for doing this. And this is going to be a complete holocaust for Mexicans who we love so much and care so much about. Well, did you see the news yesterday about deportations under Trump?
No.
Now, he has certainly tried, for sure.
Are they, they're down?
The dude is a piece of shit on immigration, no doubt about it. I'm an open borders guy, so one deportation is a horrendous crime to me. And he certainly wants lots of deportations. They are, so far, lower than at any time during Obama. Lower than at any time.
Unbelievable.
Obama set the record for, I mean, far more deportations under Obama than any other president ever. So this is reported in Politico. So I said, oh, I just wonder what MSNBC is saying about this. Nothing. Nothing. There's nothing. And then I did a scan. The New York Times didn't mention it. On and on, all the way down.
Now, can you imagine if it was up?
All the liberal outlets.
If it was up, it would
course.
Be on every single one of those. So they don't. Go, like, you guys are just not honest. Like,
so they don't. Well, I'm just going to say, I don't think you guys actually care.
Yeah. No,
I don't think you really care.
No, that's exactly
because you know why? Because they're still going to have their housekeeper tomorrow. They're still going to have their latte and their housekeeper, so they can talk about consumerism being a terrible thing and how we need immigrants and how lovely and wonderful the Mexican people are.
Yeah.
They have no skin in that game.
You know, I got to say, I think, you're 100% right. That's such an unbelievable point and an example. Sure, yeah, no, it's not actually about those people. That's not what it is. You're using them in a way to like feel like you're a humanitarian.
Yeah.
But I think there's something about, like, look, I'm kind of with you, like, at least in my, what I believe to be morally right. Yes, I think like people have the right to move. And if you move somewhere, you know, assuming you're not like violating anyone's rights, like you don't have the right to come break into someone's apartment. But I think in the same way you can move to Illinois tomorrow, mm-hmm. someone from Mexico should be able to move, you know, like,
right.
like that's the morally correct answer.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, I do not buy into this idea on the left that like somebody who doesn't want open borders is a Nazi, or that like that makes you like this evil like I think people do have their personal bigotries and their personal in-group preferences. I think that is like permeates everyone, almost maybe not every, but like damn near close to everybody has their own preferences. And I just think in America, when the left loves to like, they always love to be like, oh, look, in 50 years, you know, the demographics are changing and white people are going to be a minority, isn't that wonderful? I don't think it's crazy that a lot of white people are like, no, I don't think that's wonderful. I don't think if you went to Italy and said like, oh, look, I've got these wonderful demographics that show this is going to be a majority French country in 50 years. I think the reaction you'll generally get is like, we don't really want that.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make them like hating French people necessarily. So I'm just like, I think like I kind of like, well, it's very, as you were saying before, it's like with these left-wing people, like it doesn't affect them. And none of them are actually like their neighborhoods aren't changing and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So I understand where, while I don't like any of the authoritarian solutions, I get where like, I don't know, like we're so sensitive. I don't know, Pat Buchanan made this point during the campaign, but he was like, we're so sensitive to like, you know, Donald Trump said the thing about Mexico not sending their best. He goes, okay, maybe it wasn't a great comment, but everyone's so offended. And then Hillary Clinton says half of Donald Trump supporters are deplorables. Well, like, she's so offended that he's insulting the Mexican people, but why is she just allowed to trash our own people?
Yeah.
And again, like, I don't really think there should be some big difference between our people or their people, but why is one okay and the other not?
Again, this is the illogic that shows that they don't actually care. Ask an American if they're for open borders. You know, how many will you find? I mean, it's almost no one. So it's been 100 years since we've had laws regulating immigration. Okay. Various restrictions, some severe, some not so severe, but there have for 100 years been laws on the books that limit immigration into this country. Okay. All those laws were passed by people who were democratically elected. People voted for them, okay? Majorities of people obviously voted for those. The American people, that's how I'm reading this. The American people for 100 years have voted for laws to restrict immigration into this country, to limit it, put a limit on it. That means if people exceed, immigrants exceed that number, whatever you chose with your law, they, don't they, need to be arrested and deported. Yeah, so if you voted for a Democrat ever, ever in this country, you are completely responsible for those deportations. All that Trump was doing and is doing, and even Obama was doing, was enforcing the law.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why I don't get angry at Obama even, or Trump or any of them. It's, this is what I'm really coming down to now. It's democracy. It's the American people. The American people have chosen laws to limit immigration, and then they get upset when those laws are enforced. Same with, by the way, this may be, you may not agree with this, same with police brutality and mass incarceration. People talk about it as if it's a racist conspiracy, and especially and sort of led by cops, or cops are kind of like the front soldiers in this, and they're racist, and that's why they do this.
Oh, it's the Black Congressional Caucus, and a lot of these, you know, a lot of like people lobbied for this.
They're enforcing laws. Yeah. So Eric Garner choked to death in Staten Island, famously, right? That cop didn't do anything illegal. In fact, he was enforcing the law against Lucy Cigarettes.
Oh, I agree. And once you say we're going to have this law, well, this is the thing that I think that whether you identify as a libertarian or not, it, one of the things I think why you, you know, have an interesting, you enjoy talking with libertarians at least, is because I, like for me in general, we're like the only group that seems to really identify that, like, if you write a law, what you're saying is you're okay with throwing someone in a cage for this.
Yeah, again.
Like, that's what it means. This is what the state does. So if you're, the only problem there is that we have this law. Mm-hmm. I mean, other than that, it's like, well, once a cop says you're coming with me and you go, no, I'm not coming with you, this by nature has to be a confrontation now.
Yeah.
And so it's like, that's what you got to be like, are you, you got to look at Eric Garner and be like, are you prepared to do that to someone for selling Lucy cigarettes?
Yeah, and
if not, then we have to not have that law.
And who do you think voted for the politicians who passed the law banning loose cigarettes in New York City? It was a health issue. Guess who really cares about the health of poor people, right? New York liberals.
Yeah.
They passed those laws. Those were their laws. They wanted those laws. That cop was enforcing their laws. And then they're going to say it's this racist cop who's to blame. He's enforcing your liberal laws, guys.
No, you're right.
So stop looking at these cops, as a matter of fact. This is what's, I've changed my mind on this recently. Stop looking at those cops and trying to find their secret racism. Look at yourselves. He's Walter Scott in South Carolina. That case, when I saw that, I was like, oh, definitely racist cop. No doubt about it. Turns out this is why he got off. He was enforcing laws and regulations. He was obligated by the law in South Carolina, and it's a federal law too, to shoot him in the back because he believed, there's good reason to believe, that he thought Scott had his taser, because Scott had taken his taser. And if you look at the video, it's very possible that that cop in that moment thought that he still had the taser in his hand when he's running away from him. If you look at the law, police officers are obligated to use lethal force against anyone who has taken their weapon, even if it means shooting them in the back, because he constituted a threat to the community. If you take a cop's gun, right, and you're running away.
Well, sure. Yeah, yeah.
The cops are obligated. So even that one, that blew me away when I looked into that. Again and again and again, we need to look at ourselves.
No, you're right.
I don't mean Dave and me.
Well, no, we're
you and me,
it.
but Americans who voted for these things.
No, I think you're right, and just looking at the culture and what we we get what we will put up with or what people in general vote for. But I guess the problem is just that, like I kind of see democracy inherently as like an unworkable system. I mean, it's like you're asking the idea. That like we know, right? If everybody put as much thought into history as you do, we'd probably all starve to death. Like, somebody's got to be making food and being a trucker,
for sure.
And like, you know, it's like we can't all be that. Like, I like that Thaddeus Russells are out there, but everyone can't be one. And like, so there's no, the idea that it takes a lot of time to gain the knowledge you have. You don't just get this. You got to fucking read a lot.
I was born this way, Dave. What are you talking about?
It's like, it sucks in a way, but it's like, so you got to invest a lot in this.
Sure.
Now it makes sense because you do this as a career, or like someone like me, like I've found a way to make a career out of it. So, so it makes sense. But to put all the time in that it takes to actually understand policy, because once every 4 years you get like a 1 in 60 millionth vote, like economically it just doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Unless you're actually doing it for a career, it doesn't make any sense to actually learn this stuff and get informed. And then it's like, from a politician, their incentive, I mean, What is a politician going to get up and play to you? Mm-hmm. Play to the really well-informed people? Great. You'll get 5 votes. You know, mm-hmm. like, or what are you going to do? I mean, like, it was really depressing to me to see the Ron Paul movement in 2008, 2012, and then, like, kind of feel like Rand Paul had this thing and watch Trump just demolish it. And you just realize that, like, man, in this game, populism will beat an intellectual argument 10 out of 10 times. Mm. There's just no... You're playing to the masses who couldn't be informed about this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a problem. I don't think it's quite as necessarily the case as you're making it out to be. I do think there have been major cultural shifts. For instance, right, this idea that we must invade other countries to correct their racial injustices, right, that didn't exist as a thing until World War II. I mean, some people had that idea, but it wasn't mass consciousness, right? The whole culture changed.
Look, I mean, we abolished slavery, and that, yeah. I mean, that's like a really amazing thing. Like, not to say that there aren't some forms of slavery mm-hmm. still going on, but overt slavery, I mean, literally, it just got into the general conscious that is immoral,
yeah.
and we do not do that anymore. That's sort of an amazing, you know, step forward.
So in 1860, most Americans, if you ask them, you know, about slavery, they would say, yeah, well, it's necessary because Negroes are inferior and we got to take care of them. And, you know, that's what they're good for. So
that's kind of the way of
the world. They can't make their way in the world. So we're actually going to take care of them on the plantations and they're going to produce things. And that's great. And they, you know, because they're basically children. That was completely common. That was the standard thought about slavery among Americans, including, by the way, Harvard professors too, right? They thought this as well. Well, that's a sea change, right? The way we think about stuff. Yeah. So it's a cultural change.
No, you're right. And Gene Epstein said this to me on my podcast, always really stuck with me, Gene, who you, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, right? And so Gene Epstein, if anyone doesn't know, is a really great economist, writes for Barron magazine. Mm-hmm. And he said this is the case for radicalism. And he basically said, you know, like if you were sitting around in 1840 and you had said, hey, in 30 years, slavery is going to be abolished in the West, you'd have sounded like a fucking madman. Like that, there would have been like, there's no, are you out of your mind?
Of course.
There's no way in 25 years it'll be over. And he says, if you had sat around in like 1975 and said the Soviet Union won't exist in 20 years, it seemed great. But like these things did, these major advancements in progress, radical moves toward freedom,
mm-hmm.
they happened mm-hmm. and they do exist. So it really, that is like the case for hope and like for like the fact that, yeah, I guess I do agree with your point that, yes, it is. You can have these huge shifts. And even as you're saying, the stuff that started at World War II, like we had this shift in this direction, mm-hmm. so it probably can move in the other direction too.
In 1800, if you had told someone that it would be okay for women to work outside the home, you're insane. You're a lunatic. They would probably literally put you in an asylum for saying that. I mean, women, of course, we know this.
Could
look at their body,
business.
Look at their body parts. Nature and God are telling us that they're supposed to be mothers and wives. Hello, they can't work outside the home.
Which in a certain sense is true. Nature was telling us that, but then we beat nature. Like that's what humans do.
Okay, yeah.
Like I'm saying, like in a sense, like if you go back like 400 years, it's like, yeah, if you don't have any technology and babies are dying in childbirth and you're kind of like, and all work mm-hmm. is like requires nothing but like physical strength, you're like, it makes a lot more sense to be like, well, yeah, what are we going to do?
That's right.
I mean, there's a reason why feminism doesn't just arise in 1480. You know what I mean? Like you need, but once we built all this technology up, you get to a point where it's like, well, wait a minute, hold on. We're not having 8 kids and 2 of them are dying. You're having like 2 kids and they're healthy. And like the work at the home isn't like, now all of a sudden we have vacuum cleaners and washing machines. And, you know, it's not like, oh my God, you're doing all this homework all day and taking care of all these kids. And your job isn't like in some brutal, you know, like mine or factory. It's like a cubicle. Mm-hmm. Like at a certain point, I think human beings were just like, oh, gender roles don't really make sense anymore mm-hmm. for the first time in human history. But I think this is something feminists completely miss, where they go like, oh, it was basically that just that men were dicks for all of time. And then like somehow in the 60s, like we allowed women to, it's like, well, no, technology, like if you don't industrialize, you don't have the, none of this can happen.
Yeah.
No, you know,
technology, very important. I'm all for it. Helped a lot, but technology can be used in any way, right? The internet can be used to kill people or it can be used to liberate people.
And that's what we're that's the Star Wars battle that we're in now.
Yeah.
It's the Snowdens versus the Obama drone bombers.
Yeah. So again, it's cultural, you know, and people, and actually technology is created because of cultural shifts. People want a particular thing. Women, this is the history that you're describing here. Women for about 100 years are still doing it, but certainly for 100 years or so, you know, didn't want to spend all day mopping the floor. So the vacuum cleaner was invented, yep. right? They didn't want to spend all day washing clothes by hand in a tub outside. So the washing machine was invented, right?
And these things really add freedom to somebody's life.
Like, and then all of a sudden, so every time that happens, women have more and more hours in the day to do other things. Uh-oh, that's a problem because they're going to want to go outside the house now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you see, it reminds me of when they say...
It was because of women's desire for freedom.
Sure. Yes.
That
yes.
That created a market.
That's like a prerequisite. Yes. Like you need that. Yeah. You need that, and you also need the person who the innovator. Like they, it's a dance, and they both have to be the person who comes mm-hmm. up with the vacuum yep. cleaner is also pretty important in that equation too. But no, it just reminds me of like when Standard Oil and when kerosene was big and came out, and then they go like, oh, people started like reading at night now. It's like, you don't realize how like an invention can then go like, oh, now you have this freedom mm-hmm. to start fucking thinking. Mm-hmm. Like when you don't have these inventions, you're just kind of in the grind of like, let me survive another day. And then once you start getting a little bit of luxury, you start going like, hey, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of that like with morality in human beings. It's like you need to get almost like a little bit of wealth before you start going like, hey, wait a minute. Maybe we shouldn't be like doing this and we shouldn't be doing that. I just think it's very hard to go back like 300-400 years ago and convince people slavery is morally wrong. Or you're just like, dude, life is so like devastatingly harsh that if I can get one guy to go do some of the harsh shit for me, I don't want to hear about your morality. Mm-hmm. But like, I think eventually when the standard of living rises, it's very hard to deny that. Mm-hmm. And but I agree with you that certainly like if women didn't have a desire for this freedom, then they wouldn't have
the desire yes. and acted on it.
Yes.
Yeah. So here's another, I'll do another history factoid about this, because this interplay between culture and technology, I think, is also where libertarians often are off a little bit, even though I'm with them, of course, on, you know, letting the technology innovators free to do their things. The phonograph invented by Thomas Edison. Mm-hmm. Thomas Edison was quite puritanical, quite Christian, quite patriotic. And so he said, he announced it. This is in the 1870s. He invented the phonograph. And he said, look, I understand that you can use this machine to play that jazz music, but that's not what this is for. He issued a press release to the country. He said, look, this is for secretaries to record their employers' memos and so that they can write them down more efficiently. It would be used for work in offices. Mm-hmm. You understand me, Americans? And guess what happened? The phonograph was not so much used for that. It was used to play ragtime and jazz and blues and rock and roll and hip hop, right? So it just went exactly the opposite direction. But if Americans had been, you know, more puritanical, there were more Thomas Edisons in this country who believed in these things that like leisure and fun and Negro music
right.
were horrible.
Turned out we were more Ben Franklin. Then
we may not, the phonograph could be used to record our boss's conversations.
Right.
To this day, right? So it's all cultural. People were like, oh, thanks, Tom, but we're going to do our own thing because we want something else. And they acted on it. They acted on their desire.
I agree. And it's kind of shitty in some ways what our desires are, like not for those reasons. I mean, I don't care if like people want to have leisure, but like just the fact that you say like, if you just look around, like how much money we spend on like, say, you know, whatever, just the fact that like lingerie is like a booming multi, you know, like $1 million industry. And then like, we still have some poor kids. And you kind of like, but at the same time,
now you're sounding like a Park Sloper.
Well, no, but look, I do agree to some degree, there is a left-wing impulse that is correct there. It's just after a while, the problem is you're like, It's not something you can solve with central planning by force. It's like, look, you can always make out an argument of like a benevolent dictator, like, or like what, you know, like, okay, if I were dictator for a day, maybe I could do some good. I'll go right away like, hey, you know what? Let's get rid of jewelry and feed the poor. Like, that sounds like a kind of nice, you know, you could the problem is like, if you give someone the authority to manage it, like it's poisonous and there's no way that you're not, and there's no way you'll ever be, you know, like you'll never be a good dictator. It would poison you. And if you were a noble enough person to somehow get to this place of being a dictator and not be poisoned by it, well, some evil person will come along and kill you and they'll be the next dictator real soon. It's like, it would go horribly wrong, but just the impulse isn't necessarily like we are flawed creatures and we're all naturally going like, man, what if we could just be better? Like, what if we, but our demand is what it is.
You know, it's interesting. You raise a really vexing question, which is, you know, this thing about excess. You know, certainly lots of Americans have lots of stuff that they will never use, or they certainly don't need, right? And then the question is, while there's poverty, while there's kids who have nothing or very little. But it turns out that, you know, well, you probably know this, you know, what do especially the very rich in this country do with that excess, and what have they done historically? They've given away a whole lot mm-hmm. of it. Rockefeller and Carnegie gave away basically their entire fortunes. And that's why we have the Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and all the libraries and schools and museums all over the country, right? And still today, Gates and Buffett, Bezos, those guys are...
Charles Koch's name is on the side all these buildings in the city.
The name that will not be spoken. those guys, right, they all give away. So it turns out, and I don't have an explanation for why necessarily, but it turns out, and by the way, this is true for Americans generally, Americans give away more money to charity than any other people in the world.
No, I know. And it's a very interesting point.
So the excess, it just turns out, for whatever reason, to not be that much of a problem. Or you could actually say it's actually a good thing
because
it ends up being redistributed.
I think there's a really beautiful, I think capitalism, which just even the word is just sound poisonous, but I really do think free markets and that kind, there's such beauty to it. And this is like what I think people on the left miss often. I think it's really like amazing to me. Like I'm a Jew and I can walk out of a comedy club at night and put my hand out. And like some Muslim guy comes and picks me up and drives me home. And like at the end of it, he's like, thank you, God bless. And I'm like, thanks, have a good one. And like we're really nice. Now, I'm sure if you got us alone and got every one of our personal views out of us, they don't line up exactly, right. And like I'm sure we have. But at the end of the day, it's like, I'm trying to get home and he's trying to get home. You know what I mean? It's like we're all kind of trying to do our thing and our interests line up. And I will say, even though it's a little bit ugly to people on the left, but the truth is that, the fact that we wear shirts that were made by some like Chinese kid may not sit well with you, but it's actually raised the standard of living tremendously in China. Yeah. And if, like you said before, like when you say they don't really care, if you actually care about poor people, maybe one person on the left wing would take interest in the fact that the largest escape from extreme poverty has happened over the last 30 years. Like 1 billion people have escaped extreme poverty. That you would think that would be pretty interesting. I mean, if a government program had produced that, we would not be hearing the end of it. But of course it wasn't. It was the part of the world that had tried every government program you could imagine. They had all types of great leaps forward. And it wasn't until they finally started letting businesses come in that these people, instead of starving, started actually producing stuff. And it's gross in a way that like... It's gross because they're going through the 1860s. Yep. You know what I mean? Yep. And we look at that and we're like in this much, much nicer area. Yep. But it's like, truthfully speaking, that's kind of the way it worked. It's the way we did it. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the best way for them. And now I'm curious about your take on this. But what I find like crazy about the left wing, and this is like what just where I think the Marxists are, go from just being like, okay, you're people who see things ideologically different, to being like, you're fucking evil. Mm-hmm. For believing this, where you go like, you actually look at this as a negative. Like you, everybody on the left wing, it seems to me, as these billion people are pulled up out of extreme poverty, there you see pollution, you see, whatever, everything Marx saw about the Industrial Revolution. Like, it's this horrible thing. And for the first time in human history, average people's lives are actually improving. And you look at this as this is oppression?
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be the reaction on the left.
Yeah, so that moral change I talked about, the sea change during World War II, it was about morality.
Mm-hmm.
That convinced a lot of Americans and it changed the morality. But the other piece of that was that they were progressives. Racial liberals is what we call them now. People like Gunnar Myrdal, who's very famous, and Ruth Benedict and others, they said that it must be enforced, this new morality, with state power. They called it, this was actually the phrase they used, you can Google it, social engineering. And they understood that only the state could really make sure this would happen. So that's why, the only way to invade Germany and overthrow that regime was with the military. And with the ghettos, where the poor people were, the only way to ensure that they all had a particular standard of living and the correct schooling, with the curriculum that we write, was to have public education, right? State schools. I mean, the only way to do that. So that's why, it all became entangled with that morality. So if you become, in that moment, if you're opposed to using the state to impose that morality, you're just bad.
Right.
It's a package.
Yeah.
Right. The morality and the statism become a package. That wasn't a thing in the consciousness of most Americans. It wasn't a thing in the culture until, again, World War II. Because that's what World War II was. It was the greatest act of social engineering in world history.
That's right. The biggest government program ever. I mean,
absolutely.
That's right.
Yeah. They just broke a few eggs, like 60 million.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. It really is utterly unbelievable. But I just think, and to me, like what I see is like the, like the tragedy in the last couple hundred years is like that you have, see, like you have a really amazing, like the, what happens in the 19th century is, I mean, literally nothing short of miraculous. Like, I'm not saying that like it's a great time to be alive compared to today. It certainly is not. It's as you know. I like this one study. This was the other day. It says that like by 1895, the average American is living on about $1 a day mm-hmm. by modern adjusted yep. inflation. So you're talking about like all of human history is extreme poverty. Like mm-hmm. that's what it all is. And so it's rough. I'm not like mm-hmm. painting, but you have, I mean, I don't know exactly, but what are, we're modern humans for like 200,000 years or something like that. We're about genetically, they say what we are. Hello, genetic. And then there's only like, it's like only like 6,000 years of this society thing going on. Yep. And then we've got, you know, like this is like the picture. And then all of a sudden in this one period of time, human beings, the West, I should say, the West abolishes slavery and has an industrial revolution. This is like fucking unbelievable. Like all of human history has been going, and then there is the most beautiful like thing, like a step forward that would have seemed just impossible.
Yeah.
It would have seemed like magic. So you have that, and then you have wealth created like never before. And the tragedy of it all is that then we use these industrial wealthy nations to fight World War I and World War II. These wars that never pre-industrial nations never could have killed on this level because they didn't have the technology. So we literally use, it's like just this horrible, like beautiful, but then tragic and then beautiful. But it's really strange to me that that the left, and I guess this, I really do think this is the Marxist influence, looks at everything pre-World War I as oppression. It's mm-hmm. like everything before that is just kind of like, oh, well, the children were working. I was like, right, children were working. Mm-hmm. For all of human history,
yep.
children were working. This is the time that ended it. How do you look at that and your complaint is children were working?
Well, but they stopped working. The children stopped working, Dave. You know why? Because we've passed laws. No, it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with people getting wealthier.
Well, that's right.
So that they did not have to employ exactly. their children. Here's the thing. So in 1800, 99% of Americans made their own clothes. Just think about that for a second, everyone. 99% of Americans made or bartered for their food. That was it. All the food they ever ate was grown within a mile or two from where they lived. 1% of Americans left the 10-mile radius around their home ever in their lives. They didn't go anywhere.
It's unbelievable.
Okay, yeah. I mean, by 1900, ordinary, immigrant, working class, poor people are shopping in department stores. They're ordering by mail from department stores. Macy's in New York is sending people on farms in Kansas their clothes now.
It's nothing short of miraculous.
It is. I have a whole chapter in my book on this. It is. Now, here's the thing that's going to just blow you away, I hope. So I was in graduate school at Columbia. I'm an American historian. I've been doing this thing for 30 years. So how many books do you think and articles do you think I've read on the history of the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution and the birth of what's now called the consumer culture, right? Wow. How many do you think? I mean, dozens, dozens and dozens and dozens. I'm going to say not a single one of them told me this.
And this is what's so fucking insane.
Told me this. I'm talking about professional historians whose profession is to write about the consumer revolution, industrial capitalism in the 19th century. I mean, you can find the facts if you read carefully, but they don't want to talk about that. It's, and I'll tell you this, never once was it presented in a positive way. Never. Consumerism is always by my people, American historians, mm-hmm. which are overwhelmingly liberals and leftists.
Oh yeah. And statists.
You know, at the best, it was sort of, it's considered to be, you know, something that Americans benefited from, but it also caused them to be apathetic and it created some sort of false consciousness in which they were no longer political. It bought them off from being socialists, you know, or some kind of, you know, political actors, yeah. right? All that. It's never presented the way that I just talked about.
And as you mentioned before, when you were talking about demand and people's desires.
There it is.
I mean, it's like, it's very clear right now. Like, you can go live on a dollar a day if you want to. You have that option. We all choose not to. And the reason why human beings fought like hell, like you don't just get to hear from that poverty that you're talking about. It's like bloodied, calloused hands all along the way. And people fought like hell because they have a profoundly deep desire to hand something better off to their children, to live a little bit better of a life. Like this is why we're here, because people wanted this so much. And it's amazing to just like kind of dismiss that, like, oh, they lost what their truth. Like, you just know better than them, I guess.
No, it's just empirically wrong, Dave. It had nothing to do with their desire. You know what? You know why. You know why all those Americans wanted all those things. You know, right? Why
they were socialized, right?
By
who?
Advertisers.
Yes. Oh, that's right. That's right. Because advertisers have, this is the real conspiracy theorist of the left, right? Advertisers are just pulling us like strings. Yeah. Like, because I see a commercial now, I'm a different person.
And if you think historians agree on anything, it's that. You will see book after book after book. There's a whole sort of subgenre of American history that argues this. In fact, the first major scholarly book on the history of advertising, the title says it all. It was called The Captains of Consciousness.
Right.
They were the captains of our consciousness. They convinced us to want the vacuum cleaner and the washing machine. Because, Americans, and especially those women, are so dumb.
Right.
That they can't
right.
think for themselves. Oh, by the way, there's also just all sorts of elitism and even sexism and racism all through this stuff. Because,
well, oh my God, it's so funny.
And it carries through to today, right? So let's think about black people for a second. Well, what's their favorite music? Hip hop. Well, yeah. So there's good hip hop and there's bad hip hop, we are told, right? There's the good hip hop, like Common, the conscious hip hop, the ones who talk about politics and never talk about sex and drinking.
Right.
And in their videos, there is no evidence of their house or their car or their boat. There are no women in bikinis. They're good. But they also say this, I'm sure you've heard this, that's authentic hip hop. That's real hip hop. The false hip hop is the consumer hip hop.
Right.
The corporate hip hop. That's all sell it. Stuff that actually is popular. Is popular because the corporations, you know this, Dave, the music companies put this stuff into the mainstream. They put it on Spotify or the radio.
Right.
But if, you know, that stuff that talks about the hoes and the drinking and the boats and the gold-plated everything and the weed, that's not real hip-hop, Dave. That's not authentic.
I find it so interesting because...
You've heard this, right?
Yes.
I
mean,
it's unbelievable. It's like... So,
and they're married to this, like they're married to this view. And I feel like it does have these Marxist roots. Like I'm all completely self-taught, like everything I know.
Did you go to college?
I went to college for a year and a half.
Where?
And dropped out at Hartwick, upstate New York, then Oneonta. Mm-hmm. I wasn't into college. Wow. I dropped it. So I don't have I wasn't educated in the way that you should be, I guess, or like I don't have like this foundation. I've kind of just I just read everything I can get my hands on, and I'm very interested in this stuff. But I didn't actually start reading Karl Marx till like 5 years ago or something like that. And I was like fucking blown away by like it's almost like all the conspiracies on the right wing are true, because you read this and you're like, oh my, this is like the blueprint for modern liberalism. Like it's unbelievable now of course it's been like adjusted, but how much of it like you're like, oh, this is still kind of like exactly basically what the propaganda argument is. And there is something about they have to kind of get at, they don't believe in the distinction between voluntarism and force that like I believe in.
Yeah.
Like that, and there's something about the relationship of business is inherently being exploited. You're not choosing it. Marxists will tell you this to this day. If you talk to them, you're not choosing that. You starve if you don't work. So you're not choosing to work. You're being exploited by working, which again, to me, that's like you starve. That's nature oppressing you. That's a whole different, category. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about human, but so it's almost like they can't accept that this is a voluntary interaction with two parties, and that demand and desires play a huge role in this. So like, yet look, there is some truth to the fact that PR influences people and commercials influence, like that's what they're trying to do. Like there's a reason why it's like when they sell you a car first, it's like the happy family and the guy, and like, yes, they're trying to,
which is why
you.
Every time you put a poster out, you become a multimillionaire, right?
Because
it always works.
But your point is that it's not a top down, it's a voluntary relationship. So you're enticing someone in, but they got to want to come also. And anyone who's ever been at a company or worked with them, you realize right away it's work. It's hard work to get people to come buy your product. So you're trying to entice them. And yes, there are sales techniques, and like there is a nugget of truth to the fact that you're influenced by advertising. Like that's why they're advertising; they're trying to influence you. But it's also because like you want a drink when you're thirsty. Like, you desire a drink, and then they're trying to be like, hey, come in this drink. It's not, but no, to the Marxists or to the leftists, you're a puppet, you're 100% a puppet, and they are just pulling your strings.
Did you read the Communist Manifesto?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Marx actually, in my view, was the best Marxist.
Yes, I agree with you.
He was better than all the rest. The way you describe him sounds a little bit more like Lenin and Leninists. They were the ones who said, well, you know this thing about how capitalism will inevitably, naturally result in a proletarian communist revolution and basically just has to go through stages and then at the end of the history, it'll become communism. That's Marx, right? That's what he said. He said, you don't even have to tell people.
Yes. And he actually
to have a revolution.
Was somewhat kind to capitalism. Yeah, so, like he gave a little bit of credit.
Well, that's the most amazing part of the Communist Manifesto that everyone should read. He says that capitalism revolutionized the world. And the way he described that revolution was the way that you and I were talking about that revolution.
Right. But it pulled us out of feudalism. And right.
And people can read now and there are railroads and people can travel and move and buy things and get things instead of just living like, I think he calls them, you know, dumb peasants, which was true.
Yes.
From the land, they can actually go buy stuff. They can buy luxury items. Ordinary people can buy luxury items by the end of the 19th century. Luxury items made in Paris, France were owned by your ancestors, the immigrant Jews in this neighborhood in the Lower East Side who are working in sweatshops. Okay, we know this. Marx was really wrong, of course.
Oh, he was completely wrong about human nature. But I mean, just to say what I was saying, I feel like the left, it's just that everything is whittled down to oppressed versus oppressor. And seeing things in that mind state. And the idea that if you work for someone, they are inherently exploiting you. I feel like those ideas, which I find to be profoundly wrong, are like, it's amazing how long they've survived. You know? Well,
yeah, I mean, exploitation is just a subjective term. So, I mean, to me, they're sort of exploiting each other. I mean, you're getting money from this guy and you're giving him labor. So, you know, I mean, you can view that relationship in all sorts of ways. And I'm a relativist, infamously. It's like you can interpret that however you want. And so I don't think it's wrong to say it's exploitation. I also don't think it's wrong to call it mutual aid.
Okay, you know,
it comes down to values to me. Okay. So instead of morality, which is what that's about, right? That's just, those are moral claims, basically, right? Whether this is bad or this is good. So you talk to a Marxist, as I did yesterday, before I talked to you, you know, and she just insisted that that relationship is just exploitation, which she meant it, that it's bad, okay? So to me, it's about values. What do you want? What do you want in life? You, Dave, an individual, whoever you are, what do you want? And I say, whatever you want is up to you, and that's autonomous. I'm not going to criticize it, okay? So if you want to make more money, if you want to be able to buy those nice things in the shops, well, right now in this society, the way to do that is to get a job and work and take the money, right? Will that relationship get you what you want? Yeah, in that case. Now, if you want to live in poverty, if you want to live, here it is, like a really good Christian, you know, like a monk or a nun,
right,
or a really good, really, really good progressive or really, really good socialist, because they're basically the same thing, because they basically say that's excess is terrible of any kind, you know, then yeah, probably not. You should just volunteer and you can live on the street. Now, by the way, right in this neighborhood for a long, long time, there were these people, still are, I think, but certainly a long time ago, there were these Christian socialists who lived in these tenements with poor people and they didn't have any source of income. They would really do it.
Like in the 70s and 80s, I feel like they would really do it.
Oh yeah.
They would really, and that's like, at least you can respect that
totally.
A little bit more. Like you're more than like a modern left-wing person who literally bitches about corporations while they're on their Apple laptop. And you don't even feel like you need to ante up yourself.
Totally.
You know?
And then there were all the hippies who went off into the country and lived off the land literally because they thought that modern capitalism was bad. So I don't think they're wrong at all. I think they're completely right for what they wanted, at least what they stated they wanted. So they, you know, all these hippie communes, they became self-sufficient. They grew their own food. They made their own clothes.
Yep.
They didn't buy anything.
Bernie Sanders was hanging out, right? Wasn't he?
Probably.
He went on one of those. So the story evidently is that he got kicked out of one of these.
Oh yeah.
For like not working enough. I swear, this was a story. I don't know if this is true or not, but someone came out, like I guess someone who was on the commune with him, like claims this.
He wanted to get a higher paying job, like, you know, being a politician.
Right.
He's got, what, two or three houses in Vermont?
He made over $1 million last year, which unbelievable to me that that's not an issue for his
supporters. Here's the thing, though. It's a cool Bernie. I understand it. You know why? It sucks to be poor. I get it, man. Oh, why you would want to hide that.
100%. 100%. But I do think it's if you're making $1 million off a book about how it's immoral to make $1 million, it just does seem to be a tad bit hypocritical.
Yeah, people's hypocrisy on these things, all it does is just demonstrates that what they're calling for is nearly impossible.
Right.
Which goes for like lifelong monogamy and marriage,
Well.
And poverty.
I mean, I guess.
And lifelong poverty, you know?
Yeah. You know, I remember
it sometime.
Tom Woods.
Good luck.
Had this guy on one time who was arguing for universal basic income. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the show, Tom just starts asking him questions and like breaks down just how utterly like he was like, just take this to the logic. Like, because he's making an argument. And he goes, we should do this on like a worldwide basis though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like not just Americans deserve this if we're doing this in theory. And then he goes, yes. If we're going to argue for this in America, then yes, it should be done worldwide. And he goes, okay, so then wouldn't that mean that America would have to get drastically poorer. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, that's what it means. So he's like, okay, so now you've got that. So now your pitch is that we should decrease the wealth in this country by 70-80%.
Yeah.
No, good luck with that.
I know.
Good luck stealing that away from people. And then the other thing this is the thing I really don't get, like, I guess it's like, it has to be viewed by the left that, like, that wealth was created through exploitation. And that's, I get what you're saying with the word. Sure. What does exploitation really mean? I mean, you know, you could say in a relationship, you're exploiting someone and to some degree you are, but they believe in a sense that all of the wealth is really, at least it's implied that it's kind of stolen and therefore it's not super immoral to steal it back.
Oh yeah.
Because it's, and it really, and they will say the idea that the wealth in this country was built off slavery, mm-hmm. which I got, you know, as we were just kind of having this conversation before, I always find such a hilarious idea. Or you literally go like, it's like, so take me through this. Okay. We're in the late 1860s. Slavery, you know, we just fought a civil war. Our country is destroyed. So we're at where you were talking about in terms of poverty, and then worse than that, because we've burned half of the fucking country down to the ground. Mm-hmm. By modern day standards, the wealth of America is zero. Zero. There like is nothing. There is nothing. Now you could say certainly there were still fucked up laws in the future, and I'm not saying that all, like obviously lots of wealth has been you know attained by conquest, mm-hmm. but the idea that the institution of slavery, which every nation had that never took them out of grinding dirt poverty, that's the reason why we have all of this wealth in America, is utterly ridiculous. Now, today we do. Our military dominates large parts of the world. Like, I'm not saying we get all of our wealth, honestly. But the idea that if there's one country that creates a lot of wealth and another one that doesn't, the idea that we give it to them by redistributing this country's wealth, like, wouldn't you want to give them the knowledge this country had? But I think their belief is just that, well, they have the wealth because they exploited these people, mm-hmm. which isn't, isn't really true.
Yeah, I'm not sure this answers what you're getting at here, but, you know, there's one thing about slavery and Reconstruction that a lot of people don't know. It's that it was the first Afghanistan. The South was the first Afghanistan. I mean, that was a conquest and a remaking of the South in the image of the Northeast. Yes. And so what they did during Reconstruction was they put all the slaves in their schools and taught them to read and write and the moral lessons of Yankees, how to live properly as an American. That was number one. So, and also, well, most importantly, how to work hard. In fact, because they didn't have that idea, of course, because they were slaves. They were smart enough to not have the Puritan work ethic.
Certainly motivated.
So they were taught that work is good no matter what you get for it, et cetera. And also the women should be wives and mothers so that they could help the man, the husband, work harder because he would have a nice home to come home to. That would be his incentive. So that's they training this new workforce. Okay, so this is where it becomes like cronyism or corporatism, right? So state and corporations or state and capitalism mm-hmm. are too entwined here. And then they built a lot of railroads in the South. They built a lot of roads. They built hospitals and libraries and schools. And they modernized the South, just like they're doing in Afghanistan now. That was the stated purpose of Reconstruction. And for many Yankees, that was the stated purpose of the Civil War.
Sure, yeah.
The ending slavery was definitely a part of that. But because slaves to them were these primitive savage, slavery made them into these idiot Negroes. That's what they would say, who are oversexed and they're lazy and they don't have the work ethic because they're slaves. That's the abolitionists, this is what they actually said. This was their primary motivation. Yes, they believed it was absolutely a moral evil to enslave people, but they said that was the reason why, because it made them unchristian.
Yeah, there's really no good guys in that war.
Yeah.
Like the more I look into the Civil War, you just realize it's like the worst of both worlds. So it's like the war was very much about slavery to the South. And the war wasn't nearly as much about slavery to the North. And you want to have it in your head like, oh, well, they were the bad guys because they defended slavery, and they're the good guys because they were against it. And you're like, well, actually, yes, they were really bad and defended slavery, and they were willing to come through and just fucking rape an entire, like, fucking area. I mean, like, it's so funny to me, the idea, too, to look back that you go, like Lincoln is looked at as the great emancipator, and you're like, well, you know, if you were in the army that he conscripted, probably mm-hmm. didn't feel that way. Like, he enslaved a group of people to go, you know, like fight a war.
Yeah. Yeah. You could say, well, the South, the Confederacy was sort of versus the North at that time it's sort of similar to the Trump versus the current Democrats in that the South, I mean, Trump's not pro-slavery, at least not that I know of, but they had this limited view of the world that they had no global ambitions. They didn't want to go out and conquer other places. They were like, occasionally they would toy with Cuba and putting plantations there, but that was not a thing among the slave masters. They had their plantation. They were doing well. It was fine. That was their whole problem. That was another criticism of the South, was that they weren't ambitious enough. They weren't about a development. That's why they let their roads fall apart. They built no bridges. We in the North, we know how to organize a society for real. We're the shit. We have science. We have engineers. We build the Brooklyn Bridge and people drive over it, you know, or ride over it, whatever. And trains. They have no trains, those idiots down South. So we're going to, and it was our obligation, our moral duty. Again, here you go. Is our moral duty to uplift those people, which was both the whites and the blacks in the South, raise them up to our standards, remake them in our own image. But the thing is, you have to break a lot of eggs. Same thing. It's the same story. It's quite something. So let me ask you this. What was like the first thing in politics that you cared about?
I guess, well, like, you know, it's funny you took it back because you were in Park Slope on 9/11. So, mm-hmm. so was I. And I guess that was, that was a big deal. I was like a senior in high school. Mm. And that was, it just felt like, you know, the 90s, it was like the 90s up until
So you were right down the street from me.
I was literally, I came out of Berkeley Carroll. I forged a note.
We walked past each other.
Yeah,
many,
we literally
many times.
Might have. Yeah, yeah,
oh, for sure.
I'm sure. I remember it.
So
was
I lived
like,
four blocks from your school.
So I, yeah, I mean, I lived right in then. Prospect Heights at the time. Yeah. So we walked out of, we went from high school and walked down to Flatbush Avenue.
Yep, on 7th,
and you could, yeah, and you could literally see. I mean, people had, because I guess we had come out at this point, the towers were down and stuff, and people had just walked over the bridge. So you would see people like covered from head to toe in soot. And like you said, it was just like a crazy. It was like being in the 90s almost felt like you were like you lived at the end of history. Mm. You know, it was like it's all over. We've invented everything there is to be invented. I mean, yeah, this was a time before Google, but I felt like, you know, you everything's here. We have the technology. It's like this kind of, and then like it just seems so real. It was like shit like this doesn't happen. This is like my grandfather's time. Shit happens. And so that kind of got me interested, and I got I just became pretty anti-war. Under George W. Bush. Like I thought it was just crazy that we got trapped into these wars, but I wasn't really into politics per se. But it was the Ron Paul Giuliani moment, as it's called. That's what really got me in.
Huh.
I found it so fascinating.
When Ron Paul sort of presents the blowback thesis,
yes.
right?
No, yeah, he basically started making the argument, right, that, you know, I guess essentially his argument came down to when you murder people's children, they tend to hate you,
mm-hmm.
which is just, you know, I don't understand what human being can't wrap their head around this argument.
Well, it's an unpatriotic argument.
Well, right. And it's challenging every one of these. It's stepping on every third rail that you can.
That was a hell of a moment.
And Giuliani, you know, like, called him out and said, I hope you apologize. You know, you should mm-hmm. apologize for this. And Ron Paul stood his ground. It was just unbelievable. And then I saw him on a couple more things. Like I started, you know, looking him up. And then I read his book, Revolution, A Manifesto. It was a really, really excellent book. And then I don't know what, you know, he was making this free market argument as well, which I found interesting. And I thought it must be wrong, but I found this interesting. And then I was like, well, I'm gonna read enough to find out why it's wrong. Hmm. And then I just kind of kept reading. And eventually I was just like, oh, this is just, I'm completely convinced.
So you just happened to be watching the Republican primary debate?
Literally just happened
by
to
yourself
be watching it.
In your house,
it was at my
in
mother's.
Brooklyn.
I happened to be at my mother's place, and that was on.
Wow.
And it just literally, like, you know, it was the type of thing she would have, you know, on. if there was a debate, she would, you know, my mother was like, you know, just fairly stay in touch with politics. So
what about comedy? We haven't even talked about that. When did you want to be a comic?
I started doing comedy like shortly before that. So I started comedy in 2005. I believe. So it was like, I'd been doing comedy for like 2-3 years before that. And I just, I dropped out of school and I came back and I got a job at a company selling tickets for a comedy club. And so I just started going a lot. And then I fell in love with stand up. I always loved stand up comedy, but I never knew it was like a thing that you could go to. Like, if that makes sense, it was like, you know, it's something famous people do on TV, but it's great. Like, I love Seinfeld, you know, it's like, it's, but
even though you lived, you know, a mile from 10 comedy clubs.
But there's a thing about New York City that there, everything's there. So you can miss, you know, there could be like the biggest thing ever on your corner and you miss it because there's a million other things on the block.
Sure, yeah.
And then once I found out it was like a real thing, I was like, oh yeah, I think I could do this. And yeah.
Who were your influences? Who were the first comics you liked?
Well, like, I mean, like, I loved comedy growing up as a kid. I loved everything. But like, you know, like Seinfeld and The Simpsons and Saturday Night Live, like all that. That I like kind of grew up on all of that stuff. And I loved like Def Comedy Jam and what Chris Rock's Bring the Pain and Bigger and Blacker. Like when I was a kid, those specials, they were just unbelievable. And but then once I started comedy, when I actually got in comedy, it was like Dave Attell, Patrice O'Neill, Colin Quinn, a lot of those like New York comedians. Those are guys who really, I guess Patrice is from Boston, but a lot of those guys like really kind of got me. Like those were like my influences.
Were you hanging out with them?
Yeah. Yeah. I got to know all of them. And Patrice passed away a few years ago, but I was lucky. I got to open for him a few times and just like hanging out with him. He was just like such an interesting guy. Yeah. One of the most interesting, fascinating human beings I've ever known in my life. The guy, like literally one of these people who had like an energy that just took over a room. Like people just started orbiting around this guy. He was huge too. So it was like, it was like his presence and his size. And he was just so sharp and brutal, just like the most brutal human being ever, but very, very smart. And then you know, so he was great. And then Attell, I got to work with him and like, yeah. So all those guys I've worked with in different capacities, and it's like a cool thing. As the coolest thing about my career in comedy and in this politics thing is that I do feel like I just went from being a fan to being in the game.
It's amazing, right?
And it's, yeah, it really is. It's almost kind of surreal.
Yeah.
Like it's a weird feeling.
That's what I'm doing now with podcasting. I was a huge podcast fan for years before I started this, and now this is mostly what I do.
And now you get to just like sit down with, and it's such a weird thing where you're just like, you'll be across the country listening to some guy for an hour and a half, and you're like, I want to talk to him.
I know.
And now you can just talk to that guy. It's so weird.
So yeah, like, so you've been doing this for what, 10, 12 years now?
Yeah, 11, I believe.
And this is your, this is the thing you've been doing, like.
Yeah, yeah, this is it. I mean, I had to have various day jobs for like the first, you know, 6-7 years. So it took a while.
You're fully supporting
time.
Yourself.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'll tell you, it's the podcasts really is what I support myself off of.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, I'm, you know, it's a mix, but like, If I lost the podcasts, just doing it off stand up would be real tough. But with the podcast, it's like I'm doing all right.
There you go. Your desire to, you know, live better and meets technology or creates technology.
Well, yeah, yeah. But again, I do think also like,
and then you use the technology.
Yeah, right? I also though I don't want to just like I do agree with what you're saying. I think demand is very important in driving target, but I just don't like. There is the production and innovation aspect of well, which is really important too. You know, like
that's
very, there's like, it's like these very, very smart people that can see something that the rest of us usually can't.
This is true.
Are usually able to meet that demand.
Right.
And you need that guy there who's like, well, I just figured out a way to do this.
Yeah.
You know?
For whatever reason, we've had people who have wanted, who have had their own desire to create things like iPhones and podcasts.
Right.
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 Yeah.
And 'cause there's also these desires for like, I mean, there's desires that just the laws of physics maybe don't let, or just reality. 'Cause like, I think like everyone, we do want a jetpack for $1, you know, like there is huge demand for that, but it's just like, well, okay, now within resources are scarce and we can't produce this, or we'd have to give up so much else in society that it's not actually worth it for us to, you know, kind of go down that road.
Yeah. Wow. I was going to say, so very impressive on a lot of scores, but like one nice Jewish boy from Park Slope. who became, you know, who went his own way entirely politically. And I'm sure you've taken just a ton of heat, and it's been, it sounds like your mom's been pretty nice about it.
She was cool. My mother was actually, I never had a story, like whether it's the starting comedy or being becoming a libertarian. I know a lot of people have this thing of like, you know, my mother kicked me out of the house or it was like that. My mother was overwhelmingly cool with that stuff. And I think she had already, like, I was a bit of a fuck up as a kid. I was always a smart kid, but I wasn't a good student. Mm-hmm. I was a bit of a fuck up and I got in a lot of trouble. And I think she had already come to terms with me doing something, you know, like different.
Right.
That is, once I was like doing something, she was like, oh, okay. All right. Good. Good. You're doing something. And I think she always thought I would do something with my mind. Mm-hmm. So I had already, you know, like, she's an academic. She knows, she knew, she had already made her peace with, like, I wasn't going to, you know, I dropped out of school and I wasn't going to get a PhD. And I wasn't, so I think she was very happy that it's like, oh, at least he's doing something intellectual, you know.
Yeah, so that's really impressive that you just went your own way in that way, and then or two ways, and then and then building a comedy career to be, you know, you're living on it and living in New York City. That's that, man. I don't know if people understand that. Even with podcasting, that's still incredibly impressive. And there's so many comics who wish they were you, and I know you wish you were another comic,
of course.
Too,
yeah.
but just to get to that level is an amazing achievement.
Well, I mean, thank you.
Know
I appreciate that. Yeah, it was not easy, but it's the only thing in my life that I ever like. Really took some, it's like taking something and really building from scratch and like putting a fucking a decade plus into it.
Yeah.
But I'm really enjoying
and you're,
having it now.
You say what you want for a living.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
What, quite an achievement.
I can't, it's amazing how many people I know who are like college professors don't have that fucking freedom. Even like tenured professors, sometimes they're like scared to say.
Oh yeah.
Was there a guy who, and this is, look, you can feel however about the transgendered issue or you know, I know, mm-hmm. like, whatever is your relativist, you know, views on things. But there was this guy, I'm blanking on his fucking name, which isn't, you're always smarter when you remember a name for reference. Like, anyway, what's his name said? But he was talking about, so he said in his, he had in his class, and he said, okay, I identify as a 5-foot Asian woman.
Right.
Okay. Who has a problem? Raise your hand if you have a problem with this statement.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, like, no hands go up. Like, no hands go up. And then he had an anonymous survey later that said, you know, asked people anonymously, like, why didn't you raise your hand or what did you say? And they said, like the answer overwhelmingly was just that I didn't want to get shit for it. Of course, we all have a problem with this, but I don't want to get shit for it. And like that, no matter how you feel about the issue, that is a big problem that exists on a college campus. And that just as you say that, like, I can't. It's interesting you said that. I can't tell you how much I value that I say what I want to fucking say.
Yeah.
And I say what I believe. I'm sure I'm getting some things wrong. I get that. I know I'm not right about everything. And if someone's got some evidence, you know, I've been wrong before. And if I'll try to be open-minded to where I am wrong. But the idea that people, so many people today exist where they just don't feel free to say what they believe.
You know what? You just put your finger on what explains the whole arc of my career. So I started off as a kid in Berkeley, hanging out with black people. It was my neighborhood, and being really, really interested in black culture, but mostly black comedy. As I mentioned to you before, you know, I watched black BET Comic View every night when I was in graduate school at Columbia, and I'm pretty damn sure I was the only white dude from California getting a PhD in the world who watched BET Comic View every night. I kid you not. Every night, the only one.
You were not their target demo.
But when I was 13 years old, my stepfather took me to see Richard Pryor live in concert, the movie, 1979,
awesome.
The classic, you know, and that was it. I literally fell off of my seat in the theater at the UC Theater in Berkeley on University Avenue, and it was so funny and so amazing. But it was amazing the way he talked, because he was so free, and he talked about really that concert and Pryor's comedy, I believe, is really about freedom. And it's about how black people in these interesting ways are more free than white people. That was kind of one of the big themes of that set, right? And that completely just turned me on. And the thing was, though, I had all these ideas, and I was a talker like you, and I was a thinker and like you. And I was around intellectuals because I was in Berkeley, right? My parents were intellectuals. And the only way to do anything like that at that time was to be an academic. So eventually, it took me a while because I was a terrible student as well. Mm-hmm. I was a C student in high school, but I, you know, but it was still there. So nonetheless, I was like, that was always the mission. It just was really hard, but I made it finally to Columbia, do the whole thing, get to Columbia. I feel like I'm just suffocating all the time because what you're talking about, people would censor themselves constantly. They would censor their bodies because they were, of course, not about pop culture, and you have to look respectable in the academic way, which looks sort of stuffy and constrained, especially at Columbia. And then I become a professor, and I start to just chafe against this, and I start to say things that you're not supposed to say in various ways, you know, whether it was my style, my affect, or the content of my ideas, whatever it was. I just felt constrained and just suffering, and I just felt like I was isolated and cut off and constricted all the time for years and years and years. And then finally technology comes along, you know. It became clear to me that I couldn't really have a full-time career as an academic. I mean, they made it very clear to me. And I didn't want to be really with them either. I didn't, you know, the goal was always to get tenure, but I always said, gee, I don't know if I want tenure because I don't think I want to hang out with these people forever. Because it's like you were saying, it's this culture of self, it feels quite like a prison intellectually, believe it or not. Even though you're pretty free in your classroom, sort of. I don't know, but there's always a cop inside of you.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
That's the thing. Right.
And there's that's a really great way to put it. That there's always a cop inside of you, because it's almost like they, you know, I think a lot of people they'll feel like, you know, like something like Fox News or something, where I've gotten because I'll do a lot of panels there, and people will feel like it's like this conspiracy or like a thing, and there might even be some elements that where a couple people conspire, but they don't need to.
Exactly.
You know, like I know when I go in there. Let me tell you, if I took the neocon line, I could shoot up at I know that it's very clear, and it's.
At Fox, you could become a star at Fox.
Yes.
Oh, sure.
I mean, like you can shoot up and get your own show within a few years.
Sure.
If you wanted to be now I don't actually have the skill set to do that, but with the other skill sets that I have, if I would come out and just tone down the war stuff and really rail against the Democrats, like I know what I need to do to get ahead there. Yep. And no one has to tell you. And it has been said to me, not exactly directly, but no one had to say it. You just kind of know. And in the university, you know what's going to get you in trouble.
Well, but it's not just sort of this instrumentalist thing. It's not cynical the way you're putting it. Like you would, if you were to do that, you would still hate war, right?
Right.
These people, this is the thing.
Well, right. Okay.
They've convinced them that those thoughts are bad.
Right.
Right. And so when they have the thoughts, they feel bad. So that's what they live with constantly. They know, I'm quite convinced of this, I can't prove it, but I'm quite convinced that what goes on largely in the white liberal academic mind is shame about their, you know, inadvertent racist and sexist thoughts, that they watched porn last night, which is not so good. And
right.
That they saw the black dude on the street who was like, you know, mumbling and clearly had been doing drugs, and they didn't think that person was a good person, and they don't really kind of like how the black people behave most of the time. You know what? I'm sure this is what goes on. So you feel shame, and you just stop yourself. You try to stop yourself from thinking those thoughts, and certainly try to stop yourself from articulating those thoughts. But so that's the culture
it's interesting, because instead of acknowledging that you're human. And you have, and as you were pointing out with the Pryor theme, which really is, and Richard Pryor still is, it's funny that I mentioned Patrice, because Patrice used to always say Richard Pryor is the greatest comedian ever, and it's not even close. Mm-hmm. He was like, literally, he invented what modern comedy is. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like everyone's kind of doing Pryor a little bit, like we're all doing him.
Yep.
But I remember Patrice used to talk about this all the time. He had a very, like, he would go, he had this bit where he would be like, he would make fun of white people who feel guilty for crossing the street.
There you go.
When they see a black person, it's just so funny the way he go, nigga, cross the street and survive. He goes, be racist, but survive.
Yep.
He saw bald white guys with swastikas, he goes, I'm running. Like, and he goes into this whole thing, but it is, there is something almost more, I noticed something where that constraint that you're talking about, that the left-wing white liberal lives under, it's amazing if you talk to anyone of any other race, how free they are. Like the thing you're talking about, almost the pre-World War II thing, almost still exists for other races. I mean, you talk to a black guy, and they'll very quickly start being like, white people are like this, Asians do it this way, these Puerto Rican motherfuckers, they do it this way. Like, they have no...
Richard Pryor.
Yes, they
that's
don't
what he
care
did.
About holding back. It's like,
that's
let me... I will guilt-free tell you what I see in front of me.
That's what he did.
And it's, there's something about that that's kind of amazing. And I find this too with Asian people I'll hang out with are very quick to just kind of like, well, black people do this, white people do that. They don't care. They're like, I'm not held down by this ridiculous guilt that you are.
I'm
like,
telling you, black people during World War II, goes back to this. I swear to God, Dave, I hate to be beating a horse here.
No, I find this fascinating.
Yeah, no, during World War II, you know, they were the big draft dodgers, like 40% of draft dodgers or 35% of draft dodgers were black during World War II. I mean, they didn't give a fuck. It wasn't their war. It wasn't their country. Wow. You ask a black veteran from that time. I've done this. I've taken surveys of black veterans of World War II. They were like, nah, it wasn't my country. I did it because I was drafted.
Yeah.
I had no interest in this. It wasn't me at all. You know, the Asians who are here now, their ancestors weren't allowed into this country at the time, so they weren't even here. It wasn't a thing. Oh, and by the way, we bombed the shit out of their country and slaughtered them if they're Japanese.
Right. That's
right. And then a few years later, if they're Koreans, guess what we did to their grandparents? Those Asian kids who are here now, that's what we did to them, their ancestors. We stopped them from coming into this country, bombed and killed millions of them. Okay. Yep. So they don't give a fuck about World War II and that. They weren't part of that shaming process. The people who voluntarily went to that war or supported that war because it was a moral good were our ancestors, yours and mine.
Yep.
Especially the Jews, but really everyone, but white people, white Americans, middle class ones especially. So,
that's why they're free in this complex to still justify this mass murder campaign.
Yeah, so black people obviously never had reason to feel invested to merge their identity with America, right? For various reasons, and Asians too. Asians were excluded in all sorts of ways, horrible ways, in this country until quite recently, until 1965.
Right.
They weren't allowed into this country and completely discriminated against in all sorts of ways. They used to just seize Japanese property in California, just give it away to white farmers. I mean, it was that blatant. Right. So yeah, they had no reason to like feel American.
It always seemed kind of right, like especially with black people, it's always like the idea of convincing you that the state isn't like an agency that's here to protect your freedom. It's actually an agency that's out to rip you off. Seemed fairly easy to convince black people of that, right? And I get what you're saying. I tend to agree with all, but at the same time, I mean, if you look at the big picture, I mean, the black people vote overwhelmingly for Democrats.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
and if you go to a libertarian conference, I mean, like it's just all white men. I mean, and you know what? I'll tell you what I have a problem with is that like, so like, There are like these libertarians who went into the alt-right, took like a real hard, like, you know, I'm like a race realist now, and I'm, you know, they're like really into this like hard right, like almost like we, even like some openly, like we need fascism because that's the best, you know, case scenario for this, blah, blah, blah. So those guys will have like a 99% white audience. Mm-hmm. And then I will have a 99% white audience. Mm-hmm. And there's like a certain thing where you're going to me, it's like, so the fact that I'm all the way over here compared to this guy, like I'm like, I don't want any state at all. And I actually think black people should be a prime candidate to be libertarians because no group I think is really getting fucked over by the state more than you guys here. Yet I also in reality notice that you guys are all supporting Obama and Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And I also see, like, with the immigration thing, where in my heart of hearts, I'm a pure libertarian, but it's like, I really do see that the Democrats are just shipping in a voting block for themselves and saying, oh, you're a Nazi if you challenge us for doing this.
Yeah. So African Americans, largely, of course, don't want to generalize too much, but largely too much, have been completely complicit in all this stuff. So they were made, this was the intention by progressives, again, after World War II, was to make African Americans wards of the state. Okay, so most poor African Americans still to this day, right, live in public housing, go to public schools, have public social workers visit their homes. They're on public welfare.
Yeah.
Right? You name it. Though that's their world. And oh, and their interactions with the cops, that's the state too. So the cops keep them in line and they get all their means of living from the state too. They're wards of the state. Now, that wasn't just imposed on them from above. Unfortunately, many, many, many of them asked for it. And they're settling for that. Yeah. Too many of them. And that's so they share at least equal blame for this, actually.
Right.
You don't have to choose that. There is another way to go, but they haven't. Anyway, the third thing I wanted to say about you that's really impressive, and I, you know, it's funny, I've met so many people and so many like people who have been attracted to my work. I don't know why exactly, but are your age, roughly 30s, came of age like after 9/11, politically, Iraq war, and many, many of them either didn't go to college or dropped out like you, but are like the most intellectually curious, smartest people I've ever met and would run circles around all those professors at Columbia. If I were to give you and a professor, I'd say to you, pick any professor at Columbia, we're gonna have a debate in 1 month and you have all the time you need like he does.
Yeah.
And pick a topic, and I gave you the book, and you have access now with the internet to all the information that he does, which you didn't used to,
right?
I'm betting on you all the way, man. You would crush him.
No, I mean, and I don't even think it's as much a compliment to me as it is just the state of what these guys are doing. Like, they're not challenging their own bullshit.
Every single night, pretty much, right? You stand up in front of the world that's hostile to your ideas, right? So you're debating, basically, every single night, and you do it with flame coming out of you. I mean, you are on fire. You're passionate about this. So you really need to win that argument every single night. it's you against the world. Guess what? It's just the opposite for them.
It's like the Rocky training scene where like they're just in the most comfortable, luxurious thing, and I'm out there. It's like I spar in a boxing gym every night, and you're going to put on gloves for the first time, and it's like, all right, let's do this. Like, this is where I live.
They don't talk to people who disagree with them.
No,
you do it every single night.
They've also like there's so
you have to
much
make them laugh
stuff.
Too. You have to make them like you,
dude. They've never even there's so much of like the left wing stuff where like they've never even examined their own argument.
Exactly.
Like they've never even and some of this is kind of natural to when you have like libertarianism is not as popular as like liberalism or conservatism in America. So obviously I know their argument, whereas you could not be aware of the libertarian argument. You know, like so there's I have that advantage in a sense, but it's also like they're just not even like
very smart.
Yeah. They're not super smart people.
That's why I'm betting on you. That's my point here. I'm totally betting on you. If you have access to all the sources.
Which now we do. Yeah. You know, which I'm lucky because if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't, be in this position.
And I'll give
at
you
all.
Both of you equal time. Dude, I'll give the tenured professor of political science at Harvard or Columbia no chance in that fight against you, Dave Smith, college dropout. I swear to God, there's no doubt about it, because they never have to do that. You do it every night. And by the way, on top of that, they have lifetime appointment. They have a lifetime job.
I can lose my shit any day.
You're doing it also for your life.
Yeah.
You're standing up there basically convincing people who are hostile to you and making them laugh and making them like you, even though they started off thinking that you were the devil.
Right.
For your life, man. Every night.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's that will keep you sharp in that.
Yeah, man.
That
I want to do this, actually. Let's start doing this. Let's set up some debates with you and college professors.
I would in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Take on if it's an issue about liberty, I will in a heartbeat take on
the
any
only
professor.
Problem is we have to find. See, this is the thing. The problem will be not you doing it, them being willing to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
It's very hard to get them to. Gee, I wonder why they would be scared of debating a college dropout.
Yeah.
Because they know.
I always find this interesting. And that they know that it's like.
You would crush them.
Yeah. I find it like it's the only way. I always say this like if. Because there'll be all these like, like salon.com articles, debunking libertarianism or all these different. And it's like they'll always just misrepresent what libertarianism is. It's nothing other than misrepresenting what your argument is. And then like a lot of like boogeyman stuff like this would happen. It would be so bad. And I always find it so interesting because I'll be like, well, look, if we're so spectacularly wrong, as you say, then why do you have to keep misquoting us? Mm-hmm. Like, say whatever you will about a libertarian. It is a pretty straightforward philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's like we believe in non-aggression.
Yeah, libertarians,
it's immoral to.
They write books and they write articles and they give speeches in public.
It's like, yeah. And it's very straightforward. It's like the non-aggression principle. So tell me why we need an institution that inherently has a monopoly on aggression.
Yeah.
But they'll never kind of make that argument. Anyway, I'd be down to do that anyone. Let's do it.
We just got to find the professor
who's
dumb enough to take you on, man. Hey, look, this was awesome. I loved it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Blast. And seriously, I wish you all the best. And I'm really in awe, really, honestly.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me. And I love what you do, dude. I always enjoy it. So it's awesome to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, man. This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. If you like what you just heard and think it's worth supporting, please go to unregisteredunderground.com and become a subscriber. Thanks for listening.